everyone, to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 192, and John Lindemann couldn't be here with us this week, so I am going to introduce a very special guest, James Charlton.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, Dr. James.
I can't say ahoy hoy, that's Greg.
Right.
Yeah, I've taken that particular Simpsons references. There are a lot of them, though. That's the good news.
Right. James is an especially good sport because he's doing this on extremely short notice tonight, and I very much appreciate it. Of course, James Charlton, our Japanese correspondent, or I should say our Japan correspondent. He's obviously not Japanese, as you might have noticed from his voice.
Very, very excellent diction that he's got there for a Japanese.
I will never be Japanese. The Japanese government have made that perfectly clear to me.
Ah, yes. Of course, on this episode, we have a double dose of James and also a double dose of English. So I'm the odd man out, but that's okay. I'm the host. I'm always the odd man out.
No, I'm the odd man out because mine's the one that begins with G. So.
Oh, it's true. So basically, some kind of pun about all the serendipity here is going to be the episode name. If you haven't seen it yet, you can go ahead and guess what it's going to be before we start.
I'm still guessing what it's going to be. So anyway, we're back. We had a week off last week, and it was good for me. I have relocated to Houston, Texas for the next few weeks, which means we're recording a little bit earlier than normal due to the time zone. And it means I'm going to be sweating through every recording podcast because it's fucking hot up here. I do want to say, first off, I hope you all listened to and enjoyed the Reset Button audio interview, and also checked out the text version on the site because it's actually an interesting presentation of it all there. I don't even know if there are any direct quotes in the future.
It's more of a retrospective of the origin stuff.
Right.
You know, what the game is, how it came into being, who the hell the Silver Surfer is, why we should be interested in a naked dude on a surfboard who's made of silver.
Yeah, was that Unbroken Pixels? I can't remember.
Angry video game nerd. It was
yeah, because it's just brutal. Right, it's just brutal hard.
Yeah, it wouldn't be Unbroken Pixels because Silver Surfer is actually really impressive. I mean, I watched the video of the angry video game nerd who we met one year and did a plug for this podcast. I don't know if we've ever played it because it came out kind of weird, but
it did.
I did what I could, but the patient couldn't be saved.
Yeah.
Can I just say one thing about the angry video game nerd?
Yeah, yeah.
Best swearing ever.
He's really good at swearing. Yes.
He is a professional. He's a professional swearer.
He's my
hero. Certainly prolific.
Yeah. Well, you know, you practice that often and you get pretty good at it.
apparently I don't, so it's fine.
I hope you enjoyed that, and also wanted to give a shout out to the NWR newscast. They last year was part of their bi-monthly or bi-weekly, bi-monthly, very confusing terms there. They had an episode last week during our week off, as it happened, and since we were taking the week off, they thought it would be pretty funny to kind of spoof us a little bit, and so they had Carl on as a guest, and they played the old theme music from back when Carl was host of this show.
Kind of RFN circa episode 75.
Yeah,
right. Yeah.
I had a lot of fun listening to it. So
it's 48 minutes long.
No, not quite.
Carl was slightly more even than he was during 103. Let me just put it that way.
Oh, that's not fair.
Yeah, well, actually, I asked Carl about his state of mind after I listened to that podcast.
You thought he was on some sort of, you know, calming evening.
Yeah, I said, you know, Carl, you seemed, I don't know if it's just that you're naturally more mellow than the other guys on the newscast. And he said, no, I was on Vicodin. Carl had a car accident.
Oh, God.
Carl is a medical genius with a limp.
No, Carl had had an unfortunate bicycle/car accident. Totally not his fault. But anyway, he had told me about that, and it didn't cross my mind, but yeah, he was on some painkillers during that. So if he sounds kind of strange,
that sounds like my new RFN strategy right there.
Yeah. Well, so anyway, if you're not already a regular listener to the newscast, and you happen to like
Vicodin,
if you happen to like RFN and if you happen to like Carl Castaneda, now would be a good time to go over and check out the newscast, because it's like a it's a bridge title, you know. So
it's the Mario Baseball of podcasts. Is that what you're telling me?
To what exactly? Topicality.
Well put, sir.
Useful content.
Yes. So we are going to start the show, and James Jones, or as I shall call him, JJ, will start it.
Oh, I get the honor of this, huh?
Yeah.
It's a bit of good luck for me, because John won't be here to mock me savagely while I discuss the game I've been playing primarily the intervening 2 weeks, which would be the Sakura Wars 5, which is the first game to make it to the U.S.
And you played through it twice in that amount of time, right?
I played through it once. So I started on Tuesday, the week we didn't record, because I couldn't play it even though I had it for those days. Mm-hmm. And I beat it on Saturday without playing Friday. And all those weekdays were work nights. Pouring in about 5 hours a night into the game.
Goodness. Second work.
Because it's just like Mass Effect 2 in that respect, where it's like, oh boy, it's 3 a.m, what the hell happened?
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting that that's the game that did the same thing that Mass Effect 2 did, because there is a fair amount of similarity involved in the whole mechanic of the characters, watching them develop based on things you have to do around them.
So it's mostly dialogue trees?
There's a lot of dialogue trees. There's these little mini games that you engage in that affect character interaction and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I guess I should probably get even to more basic discussion of what this particular franchise is.
Right. Because, I mean, it's the first time it's ever come to America, so
Barely coming to America, considering you can't even seem to find it in stores.
Right.
So.
But it is a Wii game, so that's another huge difference between this and Mass Effect. We're actually on topic here.
Yeah, it's kind of a Wii game. Let's say that. So the Sakura Taisen, I believe, is the mm-hmm. name in Japan. The series is 15 years old. It's a Sega series developed by Red Entertainment, and basically the concept is that you have a group of pilots who control these steam-powered mecha in a steampunk variation of the 1920s, fighting giant evil robots. And the idea is that there's two versions of the game, or two modes: an adventure mode where you travel around whatever city that game is based in and engage in interaction with your team members in order to build trust with them, and then a tactical RPG mode, which comes into the battle play, where how much trust you've built up with them is rewarded in their performance. So the more they like you, the better they perform.
Now, two words you did not use in that description are dating sim, and when you
which it's not.
Okay, because when you compare it to Mass Effect 2, I thought, well, you know, part of both Mass Effect games is that, yes, you can build a romantic relationship with a character and eventually have sex with them. I wouldn't call it dating, exactly. But...
So, I would say that if that's Mass Effect's approach to it, this is a more, like, innocent version of that. So,
okay. Basically,
at some point, you'll take every member of your team, which is all female except for you, of course. Well, we believe them to all be female. There is a question there, but
spoiler.
This game couldn't be any more Japanese. So yes, there is one questionably female character.
Oh my god!
But a lot of times you'll run into them as you're exploring the city, and they'll be like, "Well, I've got free time. Do you want to go see something?" And then you walk with them there and interact with things in the environment. So in this case, it's in New York City. So there's a lot of questionably historically accurate things you can do in New York, but you know, you just have to sort of accept that. And how they interact with the places you take them is dependent on what their character is, and you might get to engage in some kind of mini game or anything. But it's not. I think there's only one thing in the game that would actually quantify as dating.
Mm-hmm.
But everything you can develop in terms of relationship wise is more innocent stuff. I don't even think you ever even see you kiss any of the characters.
Well, it sounds more organic than dating sim would lead you to believe.
Right.
You know?
It is. It's very much to that respect. So what I like about the game, though, is that you have 5 team members. They're all psychopaths. I mean, in some way or another.
The girls that you're interested in.
The girls.
They're all psychopaths. Okay.
The most normal character is a 12-year-old, and she's not dateable, by the way, to make that clear.
Thank God.
which, when they introduced her, I was legitimately concerned she would be.
Yeah.
So to clarify that point.
Well, it's Japan, so.
Yes. You can choose a girl to take on a date. She very explicitly says, "Hey, do you want to go play games?" instead of go on a date.
Okay, Jonesy, I have one question.
Yes.
This this character who you're confused to whether it's a male or female.
Yes.
Is it more or less confusing than Birdo from Captain Rainbow?
Considerably less.
Less confusing.
I would say that it's very implicit that she is. It's just she never really acknowledges the fact. Versus like, I have no idea what's going on here. But the most normal character is a 12-year-old who shoots people as a bounty hunter. She pulls out her guns and announces, which gun do you want me to shoot you with? I mean, except never see anybody die.
Well, it sounds, the adventure part sounds very colorful, but I mean, there's a whole other half of the game.
Well, no.
No?
There's a whole other third of the game.
Oh, okay.
And what I like about it is that these characters are really just insane. But as you get to know them, they all have some kind of thing that's bothering them. More so than just like, hey, here's the place where they developed me into a cybernetic. Let's go blow it up. But like some kind of serious issue that you have to, in your interactions with them, resolve. And they actually change as characters as you go along. But what I realized when I went back and started playing the game again is that every character changes, even the ones you don't interact with, including your own, what options you have available to you. So it's there's a lot of good writing in the game, I think, even though it's you know, it's your standard anime kind of craziness.
Mm.
And the theme of, hey, if we're all friends, we can work together and win. but at least in this game, it does substantiate this.
It's like Tales of Symphonia.
Yeah, it's very much like Tales of Symphonia, Dawn of the New World, in some of the dialogue. But,
oh, gosh.
But it's okay. It's because it actually substantiates that in terms of the battles, which I'm trying to best how to describe them. Once I called this game, it's almost like Phoenix Wright mixed with Front Mission. Because mm-hmm. you spend a whole lot of time wandering around the city, interacting with people, and then you go into these crazy-ass mech battles for about 2 or 3 battles a chapter.
So from that description, that sounds like you can shoot lawyers in the face with large robots.
is that right? To clarify, there is a lawyer who operates a large robot who shoots people in the face.
That sounds like a scene from RoboCop.
It's kind of funny you mention that, because one of your crew members, on top of being a stage performer, which everyone in this is as cover for their operations, and piloting a giant mech to save New York City, she's also an attorney. Because you can't have enough occupations at one time.
Right.
Well, I mean, the Depression was coming up. And
that's right. This
coming.
Was the Roaring Twenties. She had to make money while the making was good.
Now, James, how is the strategy gameplay, such as a third of the game or whatever?
It's pretty simple. I think I was only really challenged twice.
Mm-hmm.
One mission just seems patently unfair.
Well, you've been chiseled by infinite space. I mean,
I'm a veteran of the Infinite Space Wars. But the thing about it is, the game itself is very relaxed to play. It's casual, but not like, this is a casual game. But playing, it's a very casual experience. There's a lot of, mm-hmm. you spend a lot of time just watching these animated sequences or watching characters talk to each other and picking your dialogue.
It's like Final Fantasy.
Yeah, it is. But it's even more so. But in this case, it's delivered that way versus you standing around watching your big sprites of a character. It's, you know, animated screenshots of characters talking. But the battles themselves are, there's basically two forms the battles take, which are flight missions and on-foot missions. And sometimes they actually mix, so there's two at the same time. Where on-foot missions, you walk around on a grid and attack enemies, either with a direct attack, or you can use your current relationship to do a joint attack between two characters that's more powerful based on how well acquainted you are. And then flight missions are effectively the same, except they operate in 3D. And generally speaking, the flight missions are reserved for bosses, which tend to be huge, and you have to kind of beat parts off of them first before you can really get to them.
No comment.
This game is so weird. It could
it's
not have...
So I'm so confused. So are you the official steampunk flight simulator reviewer of
Apparently.
The World Report between this and Innocent Aces?
Like, this game literally could not have not come out in anywhere else but Japan. I mean, this game is so Japanese that there's just no words for it. I might have to get it a green card to keep it on my shelf for more than 6 months.
Do you think it's more Japanese than Skycrawlers? Because that game, the rampant Japanese-iness of Skycrawlers made it hard for me to stomach, among other actual mechanical problems that it has.
I think that the difference is that the story in Skycrawlers is just so whacked out. There's just so much crazy bullshit going on that they don't bother to explain unless you already know what's going on.
Right.
And this game, the story itself isn't all that complicated. There are monsters attacking the city. We need to blow them up.
It should at least be more self-contained.
Yeah, in fact, it's set up like a Monster of the Week anime, Like, every chapter is actually presented, like, in the next episode. I mean, it's so self-contained that you could literally pick it up in any chapter and basically not be lost. Hmm. I mean, they really go that extra limit to keep that presentation of reminding you this is like a cartoon. This is exactly like a cartoon. Look, here's the eye catch between episodes. Look at this. Here's the crazy opening sequence. I mean, it really is like playing a Power Rangers cartoon.
Okay.
It's just so weird. I don't know.
Well, that's Sakura Wars, and JJ, as I often say to you, it doesn't sound like a game that I will play, but I'm glad that you are, and I'm glad you're telling us about it. Because it's interesting, for sure.
I will say this much. I really did enjoy the hell out of the game.
Well, yeah, you tried to play it twice.
No, I am playing it twice. Let's correct this.
Is it different the second time? I mean, is there a lot of replay?
So what I did was I played it, and then there was a point where they have you make a choice, and I realized that this you can make a bunch of different choices, and I realized this choice is probably going to have a pretty huge effect on the end of the game. Mm-hmm. So I made a save right after that. So I have one right before and right after. And then I came back, and it basically was about 4 hours after that till the end of the game. Mm-hmm. I went back and made a different decision and watched a different ending.
You know what they call people who are curious about the two endings of a game?
No.
Bi curious.
Nice.
It's like the spirit of John's here.
That's seriously. Yeah, this is a setup. John's going to be thrilled. I got him anyway. I'm not even there.
Yeah. All right, well, we're going to have to move on, and Greg is up next with another Wii game.
Yeah, so I enjoyed my week off. Rare that we have two so close together. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of playing Metroid 2, actually, but that's going to wait, obviously, for a subsequent episode. But I picked up Red Steel 2 and played that through to completion, just finished it today. So good timing. To discuss it in its entirety.
And it's still quite new.
It is, yeah. It was just come out at the end of March, both in America and here. So I was kind of on the fence about picking it up. I mean, it got generally good reviews. Obviously, Neil liked it a lot. He gave it a 9. But then, I know Ray Barnholt over at 1UP wasn't so much of a fan. I mean, he wasn't scathing or anything, but he just wasn't as fond of it as some other people. And I like Ray, I respect his opinion, so I was kind of like, But then, ultimately, I guess the tiebreaker was just that, I had some time to put in to a Wii game, so I kind of fancied, picking one up there and then. Mm-hmm. And the other thing was, I just remember last year, I had, really quite a lot of fun with Tiger and Wii Sports Resort. And I was thinking, that's nearly a year ago, and I would quite like to play another Motion Plus game, actually. And just sort of on that sort of basic level, I ended up thinking, all right, let's go for it and play through it. And I did enjoy it, but I guess the first thing that I want to say about it is it's in no way does it attempt to be quote-unquote one-to-one or anything like that. I mean, it's still a gesture-based system that you're dealing with.
I was going to ask, actually, is it gesture-based with the difference being that it actually, records your gestures properly? I mean, we've all played lots of Wii games that try to make you draw weird shapes and things in the air.
with the recognition's pretty iffy, and I think in the main, this is pretty good at translating the sort of great. Vandenberg talked about this in the interview that we've got up on the site about the game. That people, they move in all different ways, and the difficulty is channeling all of that into the same gestures. How you interpret those movements, and that I think it does do that pretty well in the main. I did have a few issues. A lot of reviews that I read mentioned that the forward stab motion didn't work so well for them. Mine was more on the actual vertical slash would be interpreted as a stab sometimes. So I don't know whether that was just the way I had my body positioned or something like that, but because it certainly does require you to, you can kind of adjust this to some extent. There's a lot of adjustments you can make, customization in the options, but it does require you to give it a real whack, swing with some force to actually activate a really strong slash, which is necessary for like armored enemies or just dealing the most damage that you can. So you've got that kind of recognition to it, the kind of the strength of your swing. Then you've got the directionality, which in general it's kind of horizontal and vertical. That's it. I mean, it will recognize diagonal slashes, but in terms of the gameplay, really, what you're concerned with is doing horizontal and vertical most of the time.
It's really interesting to me that they went that route in terms of not that they went gesture-based, because I think there are quite a few gestures that Motion Plus could help with. But yeah. Especially, for one thing, the news of, you know, people complaining about the stabbing motion, that doesn't surprise me at all, because you think about what Motion Plus does, it adds gyroscopes which detect rotation, and there is no rotation in a stab, or at least there shouldn't be.
No, it's just going forward in 3D space.
Yeah, so basically what you're running into there is pretty much the same problem that earlier Wii games would have had, which...
Red Steel 1?
There are plenty of games where they ask you to do a stabbing motion, it doesn't really work that well.
I was going to point to even ones that do it less so, like even in Metroid Prime 3, sometimes when you had to push the key in, that was kind of irritant.
Right, but it's actually, this is getting a little esoteric, but Metroid Prime 3 actually uses a different detection system for moving towards the screen, because they're not really using accelerometers, they're using the sensor bar.
Right, my point is that's pretty much the only way you can effectively do it.
Well, the thing is, it doesn't work that great either way. No. That's the problem. Mm-hmm. One of the big problems with the Wii is that none of its controls, including Motion Plus, are good at sensing depth. In fact, really the only way the Wii can sense depth at all is from the sensor bar, and that's a very crude triangulation method, and it really doesn't work that well. So that's one of the big advantages that Project Natal supposedly has, is that...
Well, and the move as well with the camera is better, because they've got the big bulb on the end, so...
No, I get that, but that camera can't really sense 3D depth. I mean, again...
Not in the way the Z camera stuff in Natal does.
Right, Natal is really the only one that can sense, that can truly sense depth, because it has binocular vision.
Yeah, the irony for me, as I said, the stabbing was happening too often, if anything. But that may be related to how they kind of compensated for some of these issues in trying to get the recognition in there. But yeah, in general, I wasn't dissatisfied with it. The efficacy was pretty good. It was there most of the time, especially if, you know, I put the effort in to differentiate the gesture. And as I said, that's kind of built into the game, really, because of this whole thing of having a swing hard.
Actually, Greg, I have a question about that, because... And a lot of other outlets, they've, because of this is such a high-profile Wii game and it's a first-person shooter, they've tried to get other people from other, like on IGN, they had like a second take of...
Yeah, where everyone else gives their impressions.
And pretty much everyone, all of the non-Nintendo playing folk, always complained about the strength required to, you know, smash the armor or whatever. And it just became too tiring and just kind of put these people off, like, you know, fans of...
They've become soft from playing other systems.
That's right. They have not been working out their biceps.
I mean, you know, when you play the real man system, when you play Twilight Princess, that keeps your biceps.
That's right.
In excellent
condition.
I got
ripped on Twilight Princess.
I mean, I think, well, first of all, it is adjustable. I played it on the default setting in that regard, but you can take it down a notch, and I assume that therefore requires less effort.
Do they call it wuss mode or.
I can't remember. I remember the one way you can actually elect to make it so that you have to swing even harder, and that is called athletic.
Athletic.
That one is called athletic.
Nice.
Which reminds me of Total Recall, where he's talking about the makeup, the template of the woman. He's like, athletic, and then sleazy, demure. But so you could your futz with that if you want. I didn't. I was fine with the normal thing. I mean, I guess the thing is, the way I played this, because of the nature of the game, I just had to play in relatively short bursts because it's quite repetitive, you know, and it can get a little bit tiring if you have, you know, fight after fight. So it's just, you know, if you play it for these little sort of bursts and then put it down and come back a lot, it isn't such an issue. Now, if you were plowing through it to review the game, I could see maybe that could be more of something that you kind of dislike about it. But in general, again, that to me, I think was a pretty satisfying system, really. You know, the combat, like I said, it kind of boils down into these discrete moves and you purchase more of them as the game goes on, these sort of different combos and finishing moves and stuff that you can really, you know, do away with enemies a lot more expediently as they get more armor and, you know, they block better and stuff like that. And the I think where it's at its best is where you kind of get this sort of fusion of the swordplay and the gunplay. So it's like, okay, I could, you know, dispense with like a fairly low level enemy really quickly, where you just shoot him in the knee and then do a horizontal slash, he's dead, gone in a second. You know, and that's really what you're getting to as the game goes on, where he'll hit you with a lot of enemies. And really, if you were going to survive that battle, you need to take out at least like the low-level guys very quickly, so then you're getting the crowd down to a kind of manageable size, because you've got to deal with like people coming up behind you, people shooting you, and like you can block bullets with your sword and stuff, but of course as soon as you go to attack, you're kind of opening yourself up and all this sort of stuff. So there isn't mindless, you know, flailing your arm as hard as you can stuff. You know, the one thing about boiling it down to these gesture-based discrete moves is it does make it sort of more structured. And so of blocking the enemy attacks and all of that, so it feels careful and not random.
Deliberate.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, deliberate. So that's definitely one of the things I like. And yeah, Neil kind of mentioned in his review, there's a good sense of empowerment from the point of view, like I said, as you buy these moves, you will start to dispense with enemies that you found tricky earlier on much, much quicker, because like you could do moves that will like take their armor away in like one hit and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But of course, like I said, the number of the enemies is increased, so you really have to be able to get rid of some of these guys.
That was another complaint, right, Greg? Jeremy Parrish, he said that the amount of power that you have towards the end of the game makes it kind of incredibly easy.
Well, this is a crucial point for me, because having read a lot of the reviews, including Neil's and IGN's and all sorts of places, it seemed to me I'll try it on the harder difficulty to start, because the word was basically, look, you could purchase all the money just flies at you from the air, you can buy everything you want, crazy overpowered, you just beat everything. And in particular, Ray's review at 1UP, which I referenced earlier, he said something about the melee combos, you know, seeming pretty much sort of useless or unnecessary. I can't remember the specific word. And the thing is, when I played it on the harder difficulty, it wasn't that hard, but I did find these combos quite indispensable at times. And so I think they really screwed the pooch on the default difficulty thing. That it was just too easy, that they just dialed it down to a point where you didn't necessarily appreciate that kind of more structured, deliberate kind of element to the combat that I was talking about earlier, because it was all just sort of much for muchness, just kill people, and you know, it doesn't really matter how you do it, you could just do it really easily.
What about the game structure, Greg?
The game structure, yeah. So, the sort of criticisms of the game that I've read, I think the difficulty thing is valid. The other thing that is valid is the very Spartan nature to the environments and the level design. The level design recalls, for me, old first-person shooters, like back when they weren't called first-person shooters, when they were Doom clones or Corridor games.
Or The Conduit.
Perhaps so. I haven't had the pleasure of playing that one.
Oh, no, he's right. He's
because
right.
It really is, everything is totally enclosed, and the you know, it's very simple sort of layout. It's very, you know, I mean, the whole game is just brimming with video game artifice, you know, exploding barrels, crates, you know, the loading doors that force you to wait to load and all that. No, but he kind of revels in it, you know, the whole thing's...
Yeah, it's like, well, this is stupid, enjoy.
Well, I mean, I don't know if any of you have ever played Black, the shooter that from Last Generation.
Yes, a game that literally is like, yeah, just shoot everything.
Well, Black is, I mean, and Jeff Gerstmann complains about this a lot with Black. I've seen his video review, and he does kind of make a lot of fun of the fact that every group of enemies in the game is standing next to an exploding barrel. But that's what the game is about, and it never really gets old seeing those guys fly through the air. So I'm cool with that, you know? Like, if you pull it off, that's great.
No, I mean, I don't really have an issue with the artificing in general at all, because I love the art style. It looks great, looks crisp. Yeah, very stylized. But with the levels, they are just so devoid of any kind of life. There's not a whole lot of variety, because it's all the pretty much the same Western setting. I mean, you have one level set on a train, which is of course literally a corridor. You know, so
train's a great level setting.
These are the sorts of things. So the level design is sort of retro, if you like. Really, I mean, look, the combat is so much more kind of involved than what you used to in an FPS. I mean, this really isn't an FPS. It's a first-person action game.
Yeah.
And I, right. As someone who's not an FPS guy in general, I'm quite in favour of the first-person perspective being used in ways that are not just the usual FPS box that obviously is very dominant at the minute in the market.
Right.
I quite like that part of it. And the way they use the first-person perspective, I mean, is good, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, this was another topic that came up in the interview from the point of, what is really the advantage of having this kind of, melee combat-driven game in the first-person perspective? And Vandenberg basically said, well, it's about intensity and stuff. And the way they use the camera, the way your point of view kind of moves about, and the frame rate's very fluid, so it allows these kind of sudden, you get a sense of you dashing towards enemies and, the physicality of it, you don't just feel like a floating hand.
There's an immediacy. Yeah. Well, I know James Jones has been playing Mirror's Edge, and we didn't have time to talk about it this week, but Greg, that might be something that you should look into, because it's quite interesting. You might
if you have motion sickness issues, it might not be the game.
Right.
I don't have motion sickness issues there, thankfully.
In terms of an interesting use of first-person perspective, Mirror's Edge, I mean, it has problems.
It's a first-person platformer, effectively.
Right, which is really cool.
Going back to the whole issue that James Charlton brought up about the structure of the game, I feel like the structure of the game is incidental. Ultimately,
is it good for someone like me who I can't play games for hours upon end? I usually play, after work, just a few levels at a time. Is it good for people like me?
Yes, in short. I mean, because that's the way I played it, and I think the fact is, you each fight is a fight unto itself. Your health regenerates after you have it. So it's very fight by fight. There's a lot of checkpoints. The mini map is pretty much telling you where to go for the main sort of quests. If you like, you get these side quests that are always kind of irrelevant scavenger hunts, which just give you more money, and there's not really scarcity money anyway. So, that's they are very much peripheral. So it's easy to drop in and drop out of it. And that's probably how it's best enjoyed, to be honest. So it is good in that way. But like I said, it's really trivial. The level design, all that stuff. The story is irrelevant. It's throwaway stuff. The voice acting is pretty amusingly poor at times. But all that is kind of take it or leave it, and you could certainly leave it with the press of the minus button. So I think it's a good game. I enjoyed it. It's definitely limited. It kind of reminds me of all the Wii games that I've played. Funnily enough, it probably reminds me the most of Muramasa. Because
it's limited.
Because, there's no level design in Muramasa, for a start.
Yeah,
that's not true. Occasionally you have to go up for some unexplained reason.
I would actually say Muramasa's over-designed for
what it is. It needs to be streamlined, in some ways. I would say the pacing in Red Steel 2 is very much better, because they don't dilly-dally around quite so much.
Mm-hmm.
But, in terms of, aesthetically, very strong. Combat based. I think the bosses are also a highlight here, but not to the same extent as Muramasa. I feel like that's probably one area where they could have gone a lot deeper. And as is often the case with these kind of brawler game or combat focused games, you find yourself wishing for more enemy types.
Yeah.
But I guess the real change is more about how you dispense with the enemies rather than the enemies that come your way. But the bosses you do get are good. I enjoyed them. They were definitely highlights for me. And like I said, if you're itching for something to play with Emotion Plus and you think you might be interested in this, I think it's a pretty good shout. But just, it isn't a first-person shooter. It isn't one-to-one sword play.
And it isn't multiplayer.
But yeah, there's no multiplayer. It's not some epic, well-rounded, well-crafted story and all this. It's very much, it has one sort of strong suit, and it does that well, and that's it.
Okay. Now, James Charlton, you're up next.
Yes.
And I know you were concerned that you haven't played any more recent games, and I said, come on, you listen to our show.
Seriously, my game came out in 2005 the first time, so
on PS2, in Japan.
Yeah, well, about I think it was 3 or 4 weeks ago, I sent out a staff-wide email asking for a vote on, I had 1,000 points left over, and I was like, what should I get? The choices that I narrowed it down to were Nick's Quest and Lost Winds 2. Both kind of pointer-based WiiWare games that I was interested in.
I say you can't go wrong with either one. personally.
You said you gave one for each, and yeah. I got the end result was I got 3 for Nyx Quest, 1 for Lost Winds, and 1 for Muscle March.
You're welcome. I believe that was either me or Zach, and I agreed.
Yeah, well, what you're advocating is to buy it twice.
That's right, I said buy it three times.
That the whole 1,000 points gets used up.
Well, no, it is Muscle March is more expensive in Japan. I don't know why.
No, but he's got an American Wii.
I've got an American Wii.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, I think Jonesy's exact words were, "You can buy Muscle March twice." So I didn't up for that. <There it is. laughs> So yeah, I went for Nyx Quest. I played the demo, as probably most people on staff downloaded the demos when they did those.
Mm-hmm. Yes, a glorious time.
The glorious of 2000.
Remember that time when there were demos?
Do you remember that time when we could play demos for 1 week? That was awesome. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. And I read, I think it was in Neil's review. He gave it a really good review, and I've been playing like one level a day, and really, really enjoying it. It's definitely worth 1,000 points in my opinion. The only negative thing that I can think about it is that, well, it's probably just a restriction of the WiiWare service, but it feels like the assets are reused quite a lot.
Yeah.
Some of the background objects and the tiles that they use, it's repeated quite a lot.
It's called thematic unity. it's a feature.
It's called 40 megabyte limit. That's
yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think Nyx Quest looks really surprisingly good, but
they disguise it well with lighting effects, mm-hmm. and, you know, changing the time of day. And I really like the style. I like how the enemies kind of remind me of, what was that? Is it Ico on the PlayStation?
Ico.
The, mm-hmm. Ico, the shadow creatures that they have, you know, all black outline creatures. Nobody played that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I've been wading through Ico very, very slowly. I'm borrowing it from Andy Gergen, and I just want to let him know right now, Andy,
you'll never see that game again.
Andy, I'm still playing it, and I will get it back to you soon.
Yeah. Coming up next on RFN, more things that Johnny's forgotten to do.
It's like John really is here.
So yeah, I really like the style that they've stuck with. I mean, I think it fits it really well. I like the mythology. I like, you know, kind of Greek mythology, that kind of stuff. And controls. The controls are pretty good. I mean, I think Neil mentioned it in his review, how you can glide and you run with the same button, Z, on the nunchuck, right? So when you're kind of running across platforms that collapse, you stop running and you start gliding into the bottomless pit that you're trying to avoid. So it's like, what are you supposed to do? Are you supposed to walk across the blocks that are crumbling beneath your feet, or are you supposed to just float over the whole thing? But you don't get punished for dying, really. There's, I think, infinite lives, so mm-hmm. you just go back a few bits and you learn from your mistakes, but maybe just putting on a different button would have solved that problem entirely.
Right. It did happen to me once or twice, and, you know, I got frustrated with it, but I had forgotten about it until you mentioned it. I mean, I think it was a kind of a very minor issue, and it seems like I just kind of altered the way I played it very slightly and didn't really have to deal with it anymore. I'm not sure exactly what I did, but
yeah, it's kind of like if you're playing Mario, if dash and butt stomp were the same button, you know, you run across something and then you butt slam for no reason. It kind of feels like that. Mm-hmm. But I'm not quite finished with the game, but so far, pretty good.
Yeah.
And the other not-so-recent game is Spirit Tracks, which I'm assuming everybody's played by now.
Well, three of us have, certainly.
I think we've tortured it quite a bit.
Well, I don't know if any of you follow the Adria Sang website.
Not recently, but I have in the past.
Yeah, they got lots of updates of, like, you know, stuff in Japan, and I found out about this offer.
Oh, it's dirt cheap. I heard about it.
You saw it, right?
Yeah.
Did you see how much it was? It was 500 yen. 500
oh, that's
yen,
mental.
It's like $5 or like £2.50.
Wow.
Well, not these days, James. I know you've been here for a while, but...
Not these days in either case,
Finance-ageddon says hello.
CNN Greg there.
Japan welcomes the rest of the world to the economic hardships it's been having for the last 10
years. Yeah, for 20 years.
Welcome.
I think that's amazing. I mean, you know, if we could get Spirit Tracks for $5 in the U.S., I would tell everybody, go, get it.
I would buy 7 copies.
Well,
yeah, I was tempted to buy at least more than one copy, but because it's out everywhere else in the world, I don't know anyone else who would want a Japanese copy.
A copy they can't read.
Right.
Well, it's got the happy box art, like America.
That's right.
Yes. No Kirby frowns on this one.
Kirby scowls.
So I think I'm on the third dungeon now, the third go at the Spirit Tower.
Okay.
And yeah, fantastic. I like this, the control changes that they've made, like make roll as a double tap instead of the
That's a lot better than the scratcherific.
Make a spiral and swing your DS around to whatever else they had to do before. And this is a side note which none of you will be concerned about, but for anyone, you know, who's studying Japanese, the Japanese version of Spirit Tracks has this feature where when you're reading the text, if you touch a kanji, a Chinese character, it tells you the reading above it. So it's kind of like a kanji study.
That would have been very useful. That's at some
weird.
Point.
It's like a built-in dictionary.
Yeah. Because obviously kids are playing this and, you know, kids of a certain age, they only know a certain level of kanji, so they need to know what the hell it's saying, right? So I thought it was a nice feature. It's definitely helped me learn a few kanji.
Yeah, I think a lot of Nintendo's games, especially ones that tend to be more text heavy, have some kind of like kid mode in Japanese where they'll use simpler characters sometimes. I have a couple. I actually played through Wind Waker in Japanese, and wow. You know, I seem to remember there was something like that.
The problem is when you turn off kanji, like the sentence is like triple in length.
Right.
So it's crazy because the whole point of kanji is that with one character you're saying, you know, several syllables, right?
Now I'm having flashbacks. Let's change the topic.
Yeah.
Flashbacks of kanji training?
Yes. 13 hours studying for an exam I still only got a C on. Awesome.
Yeah, so that's Spirit Tracks. Loving it so far. Not finished. I'm halfway through Nick's Quest and halfway through Spirit Tracks.
Yeah.
Well, how many dungeons are there in Spirit Tracks?
I don't remember.
Well, because there's quite a few floors to the Spirit Dungeon, and then there's, like, I think 5 outside. I don't know whether they could consider that spoiler material at this point.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, Greg. When you said there are quite a few floors in Spirit Tracks, I was like, really? I didn't think there was that many problems with it.
No.
Yeah.
John strikes again.
You're really channeling our friend John Lindemann.
There's no overworld, right, in Spirit Tracks. That's the... there's no overworld, like...
Kinda. I mean, there's stuff to explore.
Right, no, the overworld is kind of just the mini-game of...
Yeah. Mini-game.
Actually, that's my problem. I found that the train stuff is funny because if it goes, it charts an unusual course over the course of the game, I felt, because early on, I thought it was super boring, you know, because you're going slowly, you only have a couple of places you can go. In the middle of the game, I felt like it was actually pretty interesting because now there are more tracks opening up, and then you start to find that you do some of the mini games. It actually opens more track. Well, a lot of times it doesn't really go anywhere, but it's neat that it kind of opens up a new, maybe a shortcut or something like that. Late in the game, I was fucking sick of it.
Yeah, because you're still doing it. You know, you kind of expect by that point, because that part of a Zelda game, the sort of end game, you usually expect to be zipping around everywhere with some sort of warp.
Oh no, it just
and
takes.
As we talked about, the warp system is kind of dysfunctional.
Yeah, and it feels like it just takes forever to get anywhere or do anything. And plus, towards the end of the game, the things that are available for you to do tend to revolve around more and more train riding. Whether it's mini game or, you know, they start to give you these kind of activities that are story related that involve the train also. And, oh God, it just, I felt like it was total overkill by the end, but there was a chunk in the middle where I was like, this is more fun than I thought it would be. So.
I think the difference between the games, I mean, like discovering an island on a boat is a lot more exciting than stumbling upon a station on the way to somewhere, isn't it?
It is. It is. Yeah.
How did this station get here with no tracks?
Yeah.
Oh, there's one more thing that I just remembered, very Japanesey about Spirit Tracks, which you guys might not be aware of. Do you know the stamp book that you get?
Yeah, the locations, yes. Yeah.
That is based on a real life hobby that people do in Japan, and every station in Japan has a stamp that you can put in nice. Your own notebook. I think it's for train nerds to do, basically. So basically, Spirit Tracks is a train nerd simulator.
That's funny.
Yeah, well, they all dream of saving the world from some guy with one horn longer than the other.
With a train.
Well, oh, yeah. I'm brewing a really cool segue in my mind here. So, I wasn't aware of that, JC, and that's the stamp thing. That's pretty cool. I actually do like the idea that every airport has kind of a different design, has some kind of individuality to it, or that every train station is. And actually, the train thing is interesting because I haven't really noticed this in any American cities, but when I was studying in Russia, the subway system there, I mean, you can't think of a more, you know, kind of conform. I mean, this was all built during Soviet times, and so you'd expect the train system to be, you know, very uniform and everything's the same and it's super regular now. But actually, every subway station in St. Petersburg is uniquely decorated and designed, and they always have all kinds of art on the walls, and they're big fans of mosaics, tile mosaics, and things like that. And so I remember that it felt like every train station had its own identity, which was surprising, given the culture there. Now, of course, a lot of the artwork was basically Soviet propaganda shit that they haven't taken down because it's historical and, you know, and it's built into the wall, so it's not something you can just wash over. But it, actually, the weird segue I was thinking of is that one of the games I wanted to talk about is Bioshock 2. And the...
I know. There's a segue.
Seamless, everyone.
Seamless, yes. It's an art.
Communist Russia to Bioshock 2 in
what can
one
I say?
Sentence.
No,
isn't that like the complete opposite of the objective is paradise that Andrew Ryan was trying to
build? No, it is, but, you know, Andrew Ryan is gone.
He's gone.
That happens in the first Bioshock.
And he's been replaced by someone who is his opposite.
Yes, the antagonist in Bioshock 2 is basically a communist. She's not a great character. I wasn't a fan of Andrew Ryan either, really. I just feel like they're just simplistic. You know, I just these idealists, the people aren't like that in real life. You know, the people have subtle facets.
Yeah, I think
of
some of the problem I played through Bioshock recently, and I guess the problem is when you hear about a game for so bloody long, as you did about it, because without playing it, and it gets built up in your eyes, this awesome thing. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that kind of felt underwhelming about it. And the whole objectivist thing was, to me, first of all, the fact the first character that you run into is called Atlas just was like, oh, that's supple.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, wonder where they got that from. Yeah. And the second thing is that you've got that sign saying no gods or kings, only man, mm-hmm. hoisted onto a giant bronze figure of Andrew Ryan.
Right.
Isn't that just a massive contradiction of the sign?
Well, yeah. Yes. And you know, Bioshock is you know, one way to interpret it is that it's basically a parody of objectivism. I mean, you've got this guy, you know, spouting that all that stuff, but he is pretty much the villain, or it seems like he is. And anyway, I mean, I agree with you, Greg, that I honestly felt like a lot of that stuff was way up front, and then maybe, you know, at a certain milestone within the story, but otherwise it didn't really affect the way the game is played. It feels like it's kind of superficial, and moreover, it feels like they just kind of ping you every now and then to say, hey, remember the theme of this game? Because it doesn't really play into the rest of it, into the way that you play, into what the game is all about. I really felt like it was kind of just something they were trying to feed me every now and then. And Bioshock 2 is the same way. I mean, the communism stuff is, it's just totally irrelevant to the story. I mean, honestly, it is. It's just, and, you know, I played Bioshock pretty close to the time it came out, because it came out like in September of that year, and then for Christmas on Black Friday, Best Buy had a crazy deal where you could buy the PC version of it for like $20, and so that's when I picked it up. Right. So I ended up playing it pretty close to everybody else, and I was underwhelmed with it at the time. I mean, I thought it was an okay first-person shooter. It had nice graphics, had some fun gameplay mechanics with all these plasmids that you're sticking in, and you have superpowers. I mean, I like that stuff. But in terms of its storytelling prowess and, you know, the amazing world that it creates and all that, I just felt like it's mostly dark and, you know, trying to be scary, and you've got these guys who are basically zombies. It's not that much different from Half-Life 2 and a whole bunch of other first-person shooters, and, you know, just in terms of the things that they're giving you to do.
I like the world better than the story.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, the art design is fantastic, but, yeah. It, you know, the world itself I didn't feel like was all that novel necessarily. But Bioshock 2, you know, I mentioned this a couple weeks ago. I had just gotten it and from Gamefly, and it was like, I didn't even remember adding it to the list. Like, it wasn't a game, yeah, I was particularly excited to play. Popped it in, and basically it grabbed me right away, to a surprising degree. And I ended up playing through the entire game James style within about 3 or 4 days, just totally enraptured by it.
I'd have beaten that game in 3 or 4 hours.
And, you know, it's only about, I don't know, 8 or 9 hours long. It's not a super long game, but I played through it pretty quickly for me. And I think ultimately it's very, very much like the first one, very close, which is surprising given that it's a completely different developer. In fact, it's a team of like 4 different studios who all collaborated with it, this bastard, yeah, Frankenstein creation of theirs. And, you know, none of the creative people who were involved with the first Bioshock would have anything to do with the sequel. They're all move on to some other secret project. And so a lot of people felt like the whole sequel thing was just a real travesty. And that never affected me because I didn't hold the first one to be some kind of holy object of affection like a lot of people did. So I wasn't concerned about that. And playing through it, I just kept thinking, you know, I'm sure that 90% of the people who play this don't know that it was made by different people. Because not only is it very thematically consistent with the first Bioshock, it's just quality-wise, it's very, very good. It's extremely well-made. And in fact, I think in some key areas, although fairly minor ways, it actually improves on the first game and in ways that I appreciated. I mean, there are things about the gameplay that are streamlined. There some of the more tedious aspects of the first game have been taken out or have been improved in various ways. I felt like the pacing is quite a bit better in Bioshock 2. And maybe it's because I was playing the first one on PC, which is not really my preferred platform. You know, mouse, keyboard, not very comfortable for me. So maybe Harrison, it's that. I played Bioshock 2 on Xbox, but I felt like it was a game that I could actually sit down and play for 2, 3, 4, 5 hours in one go. And it was the pacing was that good. I just kept wanting to do the next thing. I wasn't really getting into slow spots. I always knew where I wanted to go next and what I wanted to do, and I wanted to do that. The main new stuff that they added in the sequel, there are some interesting areas where you go outside. In other words, you go out into the ocean because of some leak or whatever, you know. And so they'll take you through these sequences, and they're never more than a few minutes long. There's no combat out there. You put away your guns and your plasmas. You're just walking around. But you can explore a little bit, and occasionally you'll even find Adam naturally just kind of sitting out on the rocks. And Adam is the stuff that lets you splice your genes and everything. It's a part of the story. And I think there's some vague reference to it in the first game as it being some kind of slug that was found in the ocean by chance and led to all of this crazy disaster that happens in the City of Rapture. But it's kind of neat to go outside. You know, you're playing as a Big Daddy, so you have this diving helmet and everything anyway, so it's not a problem for you to survive out there, but it's kind of neat you're trudging around in this very beautiful undersea environment, and
so it's endless ocean Bioshock.
No, but you're walking. You're not swimming. You're walking around.
You don't pet the slugs. You harvest them.
No, you just grab them, and it adds to your atom count. And the other thing is, because you are a Big Daddy, you have a lot more options for interacting with little sisters than you do in the first game. So in the first one, I was extremely disappointed by this morality complex that it had. It's really not
the binary.
Yeah, it's not complicated at all. You kill a Big Daddy, and then you say, I save her, or I harvest her. That's it. And the other thing is, I don't like how it's handled, because what it all builds up to is this, you know, choice of 2 different endings, the good guy ending or the bad guy ending. And basically, if you harvest even one of the little sisters, you get the bad guy ending. So it's not really, you know, it's not like this is some accumulation of all your choices.
I only killed one person. God.
I'm not a murderer. I only killed once.
But, you know, games like Mass Effect are much, much better about bringing complex consequences of the sum of your actions, you know, lead to complex situations.
Yeah, but even in Mass Effect where it's like, well, you're 20 good and 10 bad. It's like,
yeah,
shouldn't I be 10 good then?
Well, yeah, I mean, there are... Yeah, the good-bad system in Mass Effect is not great, but at least you can be good and bad at the same time.
Yeah, apparently you can be 20 yeah. good and 20 bad.
Right, yeah, you can. You can build up both of those as you see fit. And the other thing is, in Mass Effect, a lot of times the actions that you take, you don't necessarily know how they'll be registered on that morality scale, which I kind of like because it lets them put in a lot of options for you to take that are more morally ambiguous.
Can you give an example, Johnny? What's a morally ambiguous choice?
In Mass Effect, you can get a good rating for killing somebody. I mean,
depending on the situation, maybe that's the right thing
like
to do.
Like killing an evil person, that
right?
Kind of thing.
So if you kill Hitler in Mass Effect 2, you're going to get some Paragon rating.
Yeah, and sometimes you're not even sure if the person you're killing is good or bad, so you don't know beforehand what the result will be. So anyway, all I'm saying is, in Bioshock 2, you still have that choice of you want to save the little sister, you want to harvest the little sister. But you can actually make that choice at a lot more steps along the way. And moreover, because you are a big daddy, you the way you get little sisters is you have to steal them from other big daddies. So you still kill the other big daddy, but then you rescue, but then you take, you kind of, I don't know the verb that they use, but you take the little sister under your wing. She rides around on your shoulder, and then you can go and actually let her harvest bodies for you. She'll tell you where to go, and you go there and find somebody. You have to protect her while this is going on, which is quite an interesting gameplay thing, because instead of you roaming around and shooting dudes, you have to protect her while she does this. You have to defend the fort. And there are a lot of weapons that were even in the first game, like traps and, you know, different plasmids where you can set all kinds of traps and create a perimeter that were never useful before. And now they've actually given you a gameplay mechanic where you actually want to do that stuff, and it's fun. It's very different from the rest of the game.
Just to keep saying Mr. Bubbles all the time, like they did in the escort mission at the end of Bioshock.
No, they have a lot more voice samples for the little sisters. So anyway, and then after she's harvested all this Adam for you, then you take her to the vent on the wall, and then you get to decide after all that whether you want to rescue her or whatever. So there's it's still simple, but it's more complex. It's more interesting than before, I feel like.
More nuance.
Yeah, more nuance. There's a lot more work they need to do if they end up making Bioshock 3, because it's, you know, but anyway.
It's still basically a binary decision. It's just...
timing.
Yeah, there's another step involved.
There's several more steps involved. But anyway, yeah, I do feel like overall it's a more interesting game than the first one, and that's primarily what I wanted to say about it. And real quickly, I'll talk about Metroid Prime 3 Corruption. I know Greg has been playing a bit of it too.
Yeah, I'm still chipping away. I'm closing in on the final approach of finishing all three games on the trilogy.
Yeah.
Which will mean I have played all three games three times each.
This is only my second time playing Corruption, and I'm playing it on the trilogy too. I started it back last summer, last fall.
Yeah, well, yeah, you had it when it was. I waited till Christmas to get trilogy, so it's still been like nearly 5 months.
Still being made at that point.
Yeah, it's a, yeah. It was always a limited edition, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, the trilogy is a great package, and I think playing the first Metroid Prime on the trilogy and then going to the third one makes you appreciate some of the advancements that they made between those two games. And also, because they now have the same controls, it lets me look past... I mean, when I first reviewed Corruption on Wii, I was, you know, a lot of what I was focusing on were the controls, because that was the first time that series had done that. It was a big deal, and I still think the controls are very good.
I was very enamored with them at the time, and I still think they work very well.
I think there are a couple of quirks with the way targeting work. Sometimes you can't lock on, or sometimes an enemy will escape lock on, and it's a bit confusing as to what caused that. Was it Was it me? Did I break the sensor bar connection? Was it just the enemy has a dodge move that lets it do that? It's not always real clear. But for the most part, I think the controls work extremely well still 3 years later in Corruption. And moreover, what it's let me do, because now they're all on even standing with controls, it's let me appreciate other aspects of Corruption more than I feel like I did at the time. The graphics are really spectacular, and it makes me very curious to see what Retro does next, because this game is almost 3 years old.
That's one thing I noticed playing it through after playing two again, and I thought two benefited a lot more from the new controls than one, because it's more complicated in combat terms.
Yeah.
Like, using the Seeker missile is not interminable, for instance, in two, as it was when you were using the analog stick. But compared to two or three, they're more similar than I thought. Because two, despite the fact that it's all, you know, on the same planet, two has a kind of episodic structure to it, not unlike the way the separate planets work in the third one. And, you know, in some ways, for instance, the way you gather, you always gather in three keys in two to get into the Dark Temple and fight the big boss or whatever. It's pretty similar with getting into the Phazon seeds, except they're not keys. They come up with some explanation. Oh, you've got to blow up the two shield generators. You've got to assemble the three elements of the thermonuclear bomb to blow up the shield. They don't make it just keys, but is actually structurally quite similar. Both of them are quite different from the first Prime, which is much closer to Super Metroid, more organic and less sort of discrete like episodes to the game. And the backtracking in two obviously is less streamlined than three, because you don't just zip around using the ship. But at the same time, it's still pretty much like you get halfway into the new area, you have to go back once to get an item that you can now get, and then you go back again. You know, it's quite contained. So I felt they were more similar than I thought. Yeah. The Dark World, Light World thing, accepted.
That's interesting. I mean, when I think back to playing Echoes 2, which I like, as you know, quite a bit more than a lot of people do. Although I think it's
never finished it.
I think it has found some appreciation from people now that Trilogy's out, because they've rebalanced some parts of it and it has better controls. But what I remember most about 2, other than, you know, the thrill of using the screw attack or going to Sanctuary Fortress, is that reading the maps in 2 is very confusing because of the dark and light worlds. Because you've got these intricate...
You're not really sure sometimes what is connected together and what isn't.
And they have sometimes these odd sort of artificial barriers that keep you, you know, you can get there in one world but not in the other, and looking at the maps you may not realize that you have to see it visually before you make that connection.
That's what pissed me off as well.
No, it's a more convoluted game. That's what I mean. It's three is very much streamlined from that.
You're not really going to be confused in three about how to get from one place to the next, and usually doesn't take long because you can move the ship. So I think the only time you can really get confused in 3 is on Elysia, which is the most open of the planets, but it's just because all the places are in these pods, and on the map the pods look very similar. So and also usually you're seeing the next one from afar, so it's kind of difficult to tell, you know, is the thing that I want, is it over there or is it over there? And it's hard from looking at it visually to tell, and it's hard from looking at the map to tell, so you kind of just have to go and check.
They always pride themselves on having each room unique in some way. Even if they're very similar, there's something unique.
Right.
But on that level, I'm pretty sure that some of those rooms are identical.
Yeah, the rooms with the lift in.
Yeah,
they're annoying, because there's a lot of those that are the same.
That's true, yeah. So anyway, yeah, just wanted to kind of mention that. It's a game I had played through, I don't know, maybe a third of it last year, and then got distracted by other things. And then before coming out to Texas, I had kind of decided I was kind of limit the number of gaming systems that I brought. And so I ended up only bringing my DS and my PS3, because I felt like those are kind of the most versatile for a six-week venture out here, you know. And I could minimize. I thought about bringing the Wii, but there's so much damn controller shit that you have to bring with it.
Well, you got to take your Wii wheel just in case, huh?
No, but the other thing is the Wii doesn't play movies. I mean, it'll play instant, but it won't play DVDs or Blu-rays.
No, it's a substitute for PS3 in that regard. It's weak. Yeah.
And I didn't bring my desktops, only have my netbook, and it doesn't have a disk drive at all. So I was like, I want some way to play DVDs while I'm out here. And so the PS3 kind of made the most sense there. So starting next week, you're going to hear a lot of PS3 games for the next few weeks from me, because that's kind of all I've got. Well, no, I'm planning to pick up Picross 3D, so I'll have that on DS, but then 3D Dot Game Heroes comes out.
Yeah, I've got it. It's a 250-odd puzzle solved in Picross 3D.
Wow.
There's a demo on the Nintendo channel now, by the way, if anyone is interested in it.
It's a very good demo. Anyway, so that is going to wrap up new business, and hope everyone enjoyed it. Now we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we have some really good listener mail. So stay tuned! Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
This week, Neil has two previews for some EA Sports titles, EA Sports Active 2.0, a sequel which has more useless crap that you're never going to use, including two new wireless motion sensors. Which
strap them to your body.
Strap them to various parts of your body. And also, we're going to take a look at NBA Jam, a relaunch of the famous arcade game. Cue Boom Shakalaka quotes.
Awesome. Yeah, and I think the most interesting part of that preview, and also Neil's comments on the newscast, were that he thinks it looks really good.
From downtown!
Yeah. From up close. Because, when the first screenshots came out, everybody just went totally apeshit.
He's on fire!
Apparently looks good.
Neil also has launched a new feature, Extra Life. With the first edition, he looks at Prince of Persia, The Fallen King. So this is a kind of stream of consciousness live blog of playing a game that he and presumably most other people haven't played before. And he basically determined that the chibified cartoon prince looks silly and the touch controls aren't good for a platformer. So, James, you want to take your 2 years deferred vindication now?
It's funny because he actually mentions in the feature the reason he picked it is that, 8.5-minute tirade I had on that one screenshot after Ubi Days 2008.
Yep.
And you know what? I was fucking right.
We also have a review from Andy on Bermuda Triangle, Saving the Coral. Andy said it's the best match 3 puzzle game out there. That's quite strong advocation. You've saved the turtles, now save the coral.
In that order.
There's also a review from Carly Jung. It's been a while since we heard from her, and of course she is our other UK correspondent. And Carly turns in a review of My Pet Shop, a game where you run a pet shop. And she says
that... Shocking. Shocking!
She says...
Seriously?
It's polished and has variety, but it can be difficult to catch the animals.
Wait a minute, what kind of pet shop is this? They've incorporated the dog catcher's responsibility.
Well, I'm never going to play My Pet Shop, but in my mind, you move into a town that already has, where everyone already has pets. You go around and catch people's pets and then sell them back to them in your shop.
So basically, it's a mob pet store. That's what you're telling me.
Yeah.
My Pet Extortion. All right, so we have from Carl, we have another new feature on the site called Reset Button, which is where Carl goes back and looks at a game from a while ago.
Long time ago.
Gives background information, and then he actually speaks with one of the game's creators, and for this particular feature, the launch of it, is The Silver Surfer, which is a game so hard there was a PAX East display about how hard it is. Carl speaks with the game's creator, which is Graham Devine, and he gives a retrospective on how this awful character came into being in an NES game.
Okay, and that wraps up another meandering edition of NWR Now Playing, so get over to the website right now. Welcome back, everyone. It's part 2 of Radio Free Nintendo, and this is where we take your questions from the emails. And by the way, the address, which I think I've forgotten the past couple of times to mention, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Please send in anything you can think of. And I should note here that Carl is trying to revive the mailbag yet, and trying to revive the mailbag again. And we are trying to support each other with this. So we found that we're going to keep answering questions on the podcast. He's going to start answering questions on the website in text form. And we talked about how to divvy up the questions or how to handle all that. And my suggestion was the best thing to do is just let the listeners, let the readers self-select. So if you want us to answer your questions, send it to the RFN address. If you want Carl, if you want a more researched, fact-based or
less entertaining.
You're talking about Carl, are you sure?
Or maybe just a more succinct answer to your question. send it to the mailbag address, and I believe that is mailbag@nintendoworldreport.com.
Yes, we got rid of the bag because it sounds gross.
Yeah. scrotum@nintendoworldreport.com.
That was John's reasoning.
Yes. So anyway, we hopefully won't step on each other's toes, and if we get a question that really seems much better suited for the other venue, we might swap them. But for the most part, we'll try to respect your intentions. So if you send it to us, we will try to answer it on the podcast. There you go.
The PC?
Yes. So, and James has the first question this week.
Hamed from Oman writes, in the last Zelda game on the DS, Link had a role other than being a warrior. It sort of added a new dimension never seen to a Zelda game and brings things closer to a more traditional RPG genre. That would be a job system. It added a lot of side missions that suited its portable nature. In a way, it rivals Majora's Mask in the sheer number of side quests. Do you think that Nintendo would dig deeper into this in their next Zelda, and whether it's a good idea if they did?
So, Hamed is talking about the fact that you're a train conductor, of course.
All aboard.
In Spirit Tracks. And that's apropos since James Charlton has been playing that as well.
And Johnny bagged on the job system after.
I never really thought about it in those terms. I mean, I think he makes a good point in that it does kind of give Link a job, and I don't know if it's like, it's not exactly like the Final Fantasy style job system. I don't know.
It's a real job, not a system of actions you can do.
It's more like an actual job. He has to keep the customers happy by going fast at the right points.
Yeah,
that's right.
Oh, right. I've only done one of those so far.
Oh, there are many more to come.
Especially like if you are doing the side missions, as you were. A lot of those, obviously, are completely optional.
Yeah. Hey, you better take that Goron halfway across the world fast.
Yeah.
Oh my god, I just realized something. Nintendo have secretly put a train simulator in a Zelda game.
They really did.
They're making it so Japanese, right?
They warned you they were trying to make it more popular in Japan. Don't act surprised.
That's right, they put it on the DS, they turned it into a game very palatable to the Japanese, and now they've added a train simulator.
It's Densha de Zelda.
The next Zelda game on the Wii is going to have one of those train controllers that comes with it.
Oh, I hope so.
Screw you, Motion Plus!
I mean, what do you guys think about this? It's not a Final Fantasy style job system, but it is interesting that in Spirit Tracks, Link has kind of a job and has customers and has to make them happy. And, you know, is this something that we could see more of in the series?
It's not unprecedented. I mean, like Twilight Princess's goat herding.
Oh, come on. He was a goat herder for all of 7 minutes.
Yeah, that's a mini game.
It came into play. It's spoiler alert. It's how you beat Beast Ganon at the end.
You beat B-Scan at the end by being really fucking lucky.
Yeah, you're right, Greg. That's what they were trying to do. I'm not sure.
That was the dumbest callback I've ever seen in a game.
It doesn't really work. I mean, 50 hours later, I didn't even remember goat herding by the time I fought Ganon.
That whole sequence.
Yeah.
It was like, I'm glad we built up to this moment.
It's bizarre.
Humble beginnings, you get the idea? It's like if they'd had half an hour of the first Star Wars with Luke moisture farming, whatever the hell that is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then at the end, he had to beat the Emperor by making him wet. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. If you had the Wizard of Oz ending, you know.
Where are you taking this analogy, Greg? By that argument, you could say that Link in Majora's Mask was a professional lost and found guy. I mean, where are you going with this?
Yeah, he's kind of a delivery man in a lot of ways.
I think that the idea of giving Link more to do outside of battle but keeping it semi-consistent is something that they've already explored in the past. And then in Majora's Mask, really, he's a professional stalker. I mean, yeah. That's really his job. He is a stalker.
He does anything, doesn't he? He does anything that random people ask him to do. He will do it, right?
Hey, Link, can you go rob that bank for me? Okay, hold on.
Can you hand deliver this letter to the other side of the universe for me, please? For no money at all?
That's right, because sure. He was a mailman in Wind Waker, effectively.
Yeah, he had the hat in Majora's Mask that enabled him to be, you know, a mailman.
Yeah, but yeah, those elements are definitely less pronounced than...
Right.
Spirit Tracks.
But it is like maybe Link's job is just basically do whatever a talking boat tells him
he's
to do.
He's supposed to make people happy. I mean, that was a big part of Minish Cap where he had to kind of join people. Yeah, that was some weird stuff there. But
that was a little bit trippy, actually.
Yeah, I feel like I like the way it's done in Majora's Mask better than in Spirit Tracks because there's more variety. I mean, it's like I mentioned before in New Business and Spirit Tracks. I kind of liked the fact that, you know, he was doing these things, and I was like, wow, these are kind of interesting side quests that I wasn't expecting in a Zelda game. But by the end of the game, it really wore thin because there's just not that much variety in what you do. It's all go from here to here, you know. And plus, the train driving is already kind of tedious. And especially by the end of the game, you're fucking sick of it. So having a person on board, like, yelling at you to do it a certain way...
Slow down!
It's fucking obnoxious. I mean, it is truly obnoxious by the end of the game.
It was worse than any times you had, like, ice, and you're being chased by, like, every fucking demon train in the world.
Yeah.
And you have... It's like, well, the ice is either going to melt or I'm going
to
die.
And you have to whistle at this sign and slow down when you go through this section.
No, the whistle is the best. Who's going to demand that the train conductor blow the whistle?
In the middle of nowhere. You know? There's some strange parts to that. Yeah.
I guess, it really kind of goes to the question of, you know, how much of a sort of fully developed character would they ever make Link in terms of giving him a life beyond, you know, the typical sort of hero's journey template, you know, humble beginnings and then just sort of stumbling into this grander world and ultimately saving everyone. And, you know, because Link is a character that doesn't even have to be called Link, you can call whatever you like, he doesn't talk, it's quite difficult to really build that much around him. And then so I'm sure sometimes it might seem like it would be a particularly productive investment in sort of effort to sort of build this life.
He's wasting his time. He's supposed to be saving the freaking world.
That's right.
And he's pissing around delivering letters. What's wrong with
him? Well, you know,
I mean, I'm looking forward to the next Wii Zelda game where it's like basically a Farmville simulation and he has to dig up turnips before he can, you know, defeat Ganon or something.
They very well could go in the farming direction. That actually wouldn't surprise me at all. I mean, if they did kind of a Harvest Moon style, would not surprise me. But, you know,
Legend of Zelda, Friends of Mineral Town.
We talked about how Spirit Tracks is sort of designed to appeal to Japanese kids because that's a very popular, you know, trains are very popular in Japan. Kids want to drive trains. I say for the next one, if they continue down this path, then the next one, they could shift it to American tastes and have Link be an astronaut.
No, how about not?
Sort of aviator, maybe.
I thought you were going to say, like, X Factor contestant.
They don't have that in America, do they? They will, shortly.
We will, yes.
But, you know, you could either have him be an astronaut or a firefighter, I think would actually be pretty cool.
Firefighter.
Let me just fire these ice arrows in there. I'll sort it out.
God, I can't think of what they would do with I mean, generally speaking, all his professions are pretty boring and benign stuff.
Yeah, because it is the hero's journey stuff, humble beginnings. Yeah. You know, he isn't going to be a chartered accountant or a lawyer.
But Link, the accountant. In all seriousness, his next profession needs to be nailing Zelda. I really thought... In Wind Waker, I thought...
Welcome to Nintendo Pirate Radio.
In Wind Waker, I thought... And to some extent, Twilight Princess, I thought there were moments when I thought that they might actually make a go at a romantic relationship between Link and Zelda, especially in Wind Waker, where they were, you know, kind of the same age. They had more interaction than they do in most of the other games. And you know, and Zelda was more of a character in Wind Waker until she put on a pink dress and turned into a stereotype.
Royalty just saps the character from all people.
She went from tomboy to princess in like one costume
she
change.
She went from wanted pirate to leader of a nation. How's that normal?
Yeah. But I thought before that they might actually actually attempt to make this a kind of romantic involvement, which they've always teased a little bit, but they never actually go there.
The closest they've come is probably with Midna in Twilight Princess, not with Zelda. It's just this iffy.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of felt that would go, but then it never really develops at all. Yeah,
then
but
you're like, wait, he's a wolf and she's a crazy looking. Let's not do this. My mind can't take that.
You know, if the new Zelda for Wii, if it goes in the direction of Link actually having text, you know, or something like that, or maybe
dialogue of his own,
or even if Link stays a silent protagonist, but all the other characters get voice, and so now you really have character interaction becoming a much more prominent aspect of the game. I think having Link form some kind of, you know, relationship with the characters would be a pretty good step forward. And it really bothered me in Twilight Princess, because you did have this one character who's very clearly set up as a potential romantic interest for Link. I forget her name, but she's, you know, one of the kids.
The ones in the village.
Right. Yeah. She's this teenage girl, and she's, you know, yes, meant to be attractive within the bizarre art
the
style.
The art style they adopted for that game.
To be honest, in terms of the new Zelda, I think being on Wii or being on a console, it looks like they're going to go with the Twilight Princess kind of art style broadly, you know, the older Link and all that. It probably won't be so aimed at Japan. So,
right. Yeah,
train conductors out. You know, probably dating Sims out.
Astronauts out.
But maybe, you know, they in terms of, you know, beefing up the story elements, you know, that maybe that's more possible. You know, if it's aimed for a Western audience, cause it seems like they want that. But it's just not what Nintendo cares about in a Zelda game.
I know.
I say if you took the story elements of Wind Waker and the story elements of Twilight Princess and put them together, you'd have enough to create a full story for a game by any other developer. It's like Wind Waker had half a story and Twilight Princess had maybe like a third of a story. You put them together, you're almost all the way there.
Right.
Well, the next Zelda Wii is going to be Wii Motion Plus, right? So
yeah.
In all probability, it's probably going to be a motion plus controlled minigame for these side quests, right? So if you're trying to think of that, what could he do with motion plus?
The thing is, we don't really know what you can do with motion plus, because so few games have tried it, you know, and the ones that have been fairly obvious about what they did with it. I mean, with Zelda, this is Nintendo's flagship motion plus game. I mean, Wii Sports Resort was a demonstrator and a very good one. But Zelda
Link's gonna run an athletic camp, apparently.
Zelda is Nintendo's chance to blow our minds with what kind of new gameplay. I'm really hoping for
the core items that you would get in the dungeon being new and different in a way you haven't had in a Zelda game for a long time because of what Motion Plus can do.
Right.
Two words: dog frisbee.
Oh no!
I mean, think about the boomerang could actually become a pretty useful item. Given Motion Plus, you know, if you apply those frisbee kind of throwing motions to it, it becomes cool. Wow, it just
not
takes
those
skill.
Motions. Let's not do that.
No, I mean, I think it could be fun if the boomerang actually takes skill.
It could be a weapon and a dog toy.
Depends how you design around it. You know, that's the kind of obvious, you know, projection kind of extrapolations that we can make.
Yeah.
You say take an existing item and it's got more nuance and more skill or whatever. But I was just, you know, I haven't thought of it yet. No one's thought of it before, but they can make it possible. Because, I mean, like, obviously this was nothing to do with the controls, but like the spinner in Twilight Princess, no one saw that coming.
Right? No.
Totally out of the blue,
and no one can remember it.
No, I remember. I thought it was crazy. I thought it was great.
Yeah, it was one of the more memorable parts of the game because it was sort of unprecedented. Mm-hmm. Things like that, but that are leveraged on what only Motion Plus could give you. That's what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
Not so much on the what he does in his work time.
I basically go back to, so Link is a conductor again. Starts telling us.
He should be a musician. I mean, that would just, you know, roll two you things know, into one, isn't it? You just occasionally have to do concerts and groupies and all that. Nah.
Johnny already hates this question. He's like, I don't want to hear anymore.
I'm sick of the music thing. If they're not going to do it well, Link playing some kind of musical instrument, if they're not going to make it interesting and...
What you say is, if he doesn't have an awkward second album issue, you're not in. If he doesn't go into that level, if he doesn't get to that part of his career where it's like, oh God, I've got to do one more album to get off this major label contract, and then I can do what I want to do.
All I'm saying is, I'm tired of them using musical instruments as keys.
I know what the musical instrument's going to be in Wii Zelda. It's going to be a drum, and it's going to be from the Wii Music minigame.
Oh, so it'll make dog noises when you hit it, maybe.
The dog suit.
Well, that fits in with his dog training, so yeah.
Okay, so, Greg, you have the next email.
TJ Spike from the forums writes, with the confirmation from Nintendo that the 3DS will be backwards compatible with the DS/DSi, and the rumour that the 3DS will launch in October, do you think they will have some way of letting consumers transfer their DSiWare games to the 3DS? I realise that this may not be a concern to you guys, since, as I recall, most of you don't own DSis.
Hold on right there. Just wanted to note, James has a DSi XL, and John Lindemann has a DSi.
We are at 50%.
Of our normal crew, I don't know, James Charlton, I don't know if you have one, but our normal crew is 50%. That's pretty good.
And neither of them bought them.
Neither of them bought them.
For a useless fucking iteration of hardware, 50% is not bad. Okay.
To be fair, I can also use mine as like a boat if I need to go out to sea.
Life raft. Also, are you disappointed that there hasn't been much more interaction between the Wii and DS? The only significant use I can think of is Pokemon Battle Revolution, where you control your Pokemon with the DS. Companies could do something like Electronic Arts does with Scrabble games on iTunes. They let you buy Scrabble on the iPad and use your iPhone or iPod Touch as your tile rack. I'm not saying every game needs to use it, but it could add some value to a game, may even boost sales of some games that use this kind of feature.
Well, the first part is pretty easy to answer. The answer is no.
I agree.
You will never, ever be able to transfer anything from your DSi to your 3DS. End of story.
Greg and I have...
Yeah, so you've seen my feeling. Obviously, a lot of people are trying to infer for the whole thing with the DSi and DSi XL. There's no way of transferring it over. Yeah. And the thing is, you know, that situation, I think, you know, the DSi XL principally exists as to sit on shelves alongside the DSi, the current DSi, the normal DSi.
It's a third pillar, if you like.
No, it's not.
It's more like, you know, just tailoring the options for all the, you know, for what people want. So the point is, they're not expecting people to have two, and so why would you want to transfer them over? Now, obviously, you've got your real ardent, you know, Nintendo portable collectors out there that kind of end up getting everything. Or, you know, you've got your reviewers, your people at the gaming press outlets where they might would like to transfer them over, and that's a pain. And
it's like Sony removing Linux support from PS3. Like, almost no one cares. The people who care are going to make a big fuss about it.
Now, 3DS is completely different.
Yes.
Because you're dealing with a situation there where Nintendo, through various means... Obviously, the main one being exclusive software that takes advantage of the 3DS's exclusive features. But they're going to want to encourage people to upgrade, to say, this is the next step along. You know, you're moving on from your DS.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is backwards compatible, so you don't have to worry about going back to your DS. You know, you can upgrade to this. And therefore, there is more of an imperative to give people that option of transferring games from their DSi to the 3DS. So, obviously, there's more reason to do it. Does that mean they'll do it?
No way.
I would say if I have to come down on one side or the other, I think they'll do something. It might be more convoluted and than it should be.
You have to mail your DSi to Nintendo, and they will do it for you.
This all comes down to the fact that they don't use an account; they tie it to the system, right?
But there is a way to do the account. There's the issue of there's a Club Nintendo in every region now.
Yeah, but you don't. But you don't have to have joined Club Nintendo and been registered to it when you bought the game.
Club Nintendo is an opt-in system.
Right, but you can't go back and retroactively opt in these DSiWare games.
Sure,
you've already bought them.
No, sure you can.
Well, it registers them when you buy them.
Yes, but it is within Nintendo's power to.
You are assuming they're going to do a lot.
If you opt your system in a later date, then it goes and ties in what's on the system into that account after that. Then it could, but that's what I'm saying. It probably might be more convoluted than you'd like.
Oh, I'm sure it will be.
But
convoluted.
But I still feel like there will be. You know, very significant demand there from people in a way that you're not seeing with the whole DSi XL issue, right, for the very reasons that Jolly talked about.
There will be a shitstorm if you can't transfer your purchases to the 3DS.
I mean, the other analog, of course, is, you know, PSP and PSP Go, removing the UMD and
well, again,
all that stuff.
Sony didn't really expect people to upgrade to the Go. That's not
what
it's
for. The idea of the Go was a kind of parallel stream,
right,
wasn't it? To
or
some
a
extent.
Real stream would be a better way of playing it.
Because, I mean, ultimately, it is still the same hardware, whereas, I mean, 3DS, you know, is, as Reggie has just come out and said it, you know, this is the next step. You know, this isn't a hardware revision or a minor iteration. This is the next generational kind of leap.
Right.
Well, what I hope they do, what I hope
four
they
cameras,
do is
that's what
they
I want.
Start an iTunes-style thing that you have an account, and you can access it on any 3DS that you own. They'll have a virtual console for portable consoles, and they'll just start from scratch. This will be like the next generation of the shopping channel.
Mm-hmm. I think they will do that. I really do. I think they will start from scratch, but then what they may have to do is then, like I said, have some sort of convoluted way of kind of piggybacking the old stuff tied to your DSi into that new system. And that's what it may be kind of awkward, but they'll have something, I really think so.
Right. See, I don't like whenever I hear they're going to try to design a new system based on something online, because it just ends in fire and people being upset, internet posts, and it's just terrible.
No one could blame you for being skeptical about that.
Anytime they do something related to online, be it purchases, play, whatever, they just screw it up. I mean, they just do.
Yeah, but eventually they have to get it right.
No, they don't. Have they tried?
Eventually.
They're not really getting penalized in the market yet.
But I mean, they are getting better, you know, over time. And eventually it will get to an acceptable place.
See, I just feel like they might view the DSi, even right now, the DSi isn't a huge market presence. I mean, it does all right, but I don't know that it's reached a critical mass at the point that they feel like they have to accommodate its users.
I know what you mean. It's not the whole DS user base. I mean, right, you know, the 125 million or whatever the figure is worldwide.
It's not just the DSi owners either. It's the DSi owners who then went and bought DSiWare software. And to be honest, there's a lot of DSiWare software out there, but there's not a lot of it worth buying.
Well, no, but I mean, the other thing is you have to realize when the DSi launched, for a fair bit, they were giving away free points for people to encourage them to go download. And then with things like the XL, it comes with DSiWare preloaded.
I don't think you'll be able to transfer that stuff over. I think that
maybe not. But they are very actively trying to encourage DSi owners in a way that they did not with Wii.
Yes,
they're
exactly.
They're trying to encourage people to go buy download games.
And that does, I think, foreshadow what James Charlton is talking about in terms of they will probably try and further it.
Well, it's so lucrative.
It's exactly. I mean, the money's there. I think portable virtual console is as predicted
well,
that.
And
I
it
think
solves
that is
all their
happen.
Problems with fucking R4 chips and used game sales and rentals and every, you know. It solves all that.
It just diversifies your revenue stream so that you're not as exposed to those that are vulnerable to this piracy problem. Nintendo in Europe's talking about the idea that, you know, and where they're getting this figure from, I don't know what kind of models. But it's like 50%, their revenue is 50% of what it could be because of all the piracy, basically. You know what I mean? If that bad, why wouldn't you want to diversify out of that revenue stream into one that's more difficult? You know,
it's still insane number, but that's more rational considering you have an overland route to Russia and China.
Yeah.
Whereas ours have to come over the ocean.
Yes.
Well, how much of that could be avoided if they had fucking demos for everything so people could try the game so they wouldn't
But you have to understand, like, you know? The majority of the software that come in Russia itself is pirated. in China, it's pirated. So this, they export.
Yeah, that's the mainstream. Yeah,
so, well, JC, I'm not sure I agree with your viewpoint there. I mean, there's almost every PC game has a demo. And we know that PC games are like 90-95% pirated. So
it's horrible.
That's true.
Yeah. I don't know how valid that assumption is.
I'm not sure how much it is people pirating the games themselves or pirate copies or bootleg copies of these games being out there. I mean, I know that I can't remember what forum member it was who used to post these bad bootlegs that he would find in markets in England.
Oh, but they would just... I had this amazing version of Driver 2 for Game Boy Advance that I got from Russia. And there is there exists such a thing as Driver 2 for GBA, but that's what I was playing, but the packaging that came with this, and I think I bought it for like equivalent of about $10, totally worth it for the packaging alone, because you had this bizarre poor photocopied box art, and the manual was the manual was like 3 pages of like what someone thought this game was about, and then the next 3 pages were like a repeat of the first three, so they just kind of stopped bothering trying to translate the manual, and so they just repeated that for 3 more pages, and then the last 2 or 3 pages were from a completely different game. It's hilarious. Well, we do have another part of this question, which was about...
Oh, the connectivity?
Yeah, Wii and DS connectivity.
Well, I'm definitely disappointed, because I was a big fan of the GBA GameCube connectivity, and I fell for that.
I was a fan of the games that supported GameCube and GBA. I wasn't a fan of the connectivity itself. I thought it really didn't get very far past gimmick. I mean, I didn't think they ever did anything super interesting or
Pac-Man versus
or innovative.
Hey, don't slag off Pac-Man versus. I like that game.
Pac-Man versus is cool, but you could have done that split screen. I mean, there's not really a super strong impetus for doing that connectivity.
Well, I mean, it kept your information secret from the other players. Besides that, yeah.
Yeah,
I played that with non-game playing, people, just like regular people, and they loved it.
Sure.
Where did you get non-game playing people with Game Boy Advances and Link cables?
Well, you only needed one Game Boy and one Link cable. That was the good thing about it. They were Pac-Man on the Game Boy, and the rest of you were the Ghost, right?
Oh, I see. I thought it was the other way around.
Everybody understands Pac-Man, so they knew what to do, and it was great.
Yeah, was the easiest one to actually implement from a
consumer. It was the only one you could actually implement.
Well, I mean, am I disappointed personally? Not particularly. I didn't really get a chance to play any of the connectivity games on the GameCube because of this, because of the problem of, who's going to have all the stuff for it and all that. But I mean, I am slightly surprised that it hasn't, there hasn't been some of that, considering obviously, the wireless aspect makes it a lot easier.
Well, and both systems are
and
so
125 million DSs makes it a lot easier too, to be honest.
Yeah,
but you've got the GBA was doing well, obviously, relatively speaking to the GameCube, but of course the DS is, it sold the original Game Boy now, it's so immense. But of course, that's the thing, the Wii has been doing well, and that's why we don't have it.
The
GBA stuff was a prop to the GameCube that wasn't performing so well. You've got your GBA, but if you want to get the most out of your GBA, you got to get a GameCube and play Four Swords or whatever. I think the fact that they haven't done it on Wii and DS, when it actually makes more sense, reveals how cynical it was in the first place. Because you could say, we've got these really good ideas for games and we just want to do it and we can make it happen with this stuff. If they were so passionate about those kinds of games, they could have done it bigger and better and more accessible with Wii and DS, but they haven't done that. Was almost entirely on that cynical market side.
Because he only says they've done it for Pokemon Battle Revolution, but technically they did it for Pokemon Ranch too, which is the highlight of the gaming achievement.
You stole your Pokemon.
But guys, don't forget about the Final Fantasy game. I mean, I know it was kind of forgettable.
Yeah, I was thinking more from Nintendo's point of view in terms of pushing the hardware, because they're the people
that was the DS game they copied to the Wii, right?
Yes, upported.
Yeah, but it's quite interesting. I mean, you can play with those together, and you know, it's highly connective between the two. It's all wireless. And
put it this way, I would have played the Crystal Chronicles game if it was like on a DS and a Wii, the original GameCube version.
The original,
yeah. Oh sure.
If that came out a new version on the Wii with, you know, DS connectivity, I'd play that.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
They're too busy turning it into butt bumping game. The game that I played and still cannot put a category on.
Yeah. I do think, actually, maybe the gameplay possibilities are limited. I think there's actually a lot of potential.
No, I kind of agree.
Yeah, I just think... It's...
Clearly, they're not that enamored with that potential.
Right. There's potential, but they don't care.
Yeah. But I do think, actually, I think third parties have been, you know, surprisingly stagnant on this, you know, impotent on making this work. I mean, I think the Scrabble example is a very good example. That's the kind of thing that, you know, would be a totally optional mode, but it would actually be really cool to give each player his own screen for that. And it's easy to do. There's no wires. You already got two or three DSs lying around the house, probably. And the fact that it hasn't been done is a little surprising to me. And I have to wonder if maybe the reason for that is that the middleware or whatever the tools that Nintendo has for implementing the connectivity to DS are just hard to use or hard to get, you know, or just crap. Mm. Because maybe that would explain why more developers aren't doing it.
Yeah, maybe it's not as easy as we think it is either. Maybe it just takes... I mean, I'm sure it takes a lot of extra planning. I mean, it's a complicated thing you're asking your developers to do.
Right.
You're basically saying, all right, I want you to develop this game to run on two separate platforms.
I mean, Square talked about how they basically had like a middleware function to translate DS games to Wii.
Yeah, they literally translated a DS game to
Wii. Hypothetically could do that for subsequent games. Yeah, they kind of developed it as a system for that, for more than just that one Crystal Chronicles game.
And then Nintendo pretty much did the same thing with WarioWare DIY, where they, you know, you can make all these games on your DS that are compatible with this WiiWare channel, so you can play exactly the same minigame on the Wii. And so everything you can make on the DS game will work on the Wii, and I'm sure a lot of work went into making that possible. And I do think DIY is... The unfortunate thing is you have to buy the WiiWare channel, because that really right. should be included with the DS game.
Even just a scale-back version of it that just lets you send and receive.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, the fact is that if you have the WiiWare channel, there's actually a lot of very cool interaction there. And not only can you play the games that you've made on your Wii, but then you can also send them to other people who don't even own the DS game. I mean, you can already send it from one DS to another, but if you have the channel, you can now send it from one Wii to another, which is just lets you share it even more. It's a really cool system. I would also say that, you know, there are things built into the channels, like a Nintendo channel, where you can download DS demos. And yeah, we complain about the selection a lot, but when there are demos up there I'm interested in playing, I really appreciate that feature because it works extremely well. It's very simple to use, and it lets me try out games that otherwise I wouldn't be able to play. I mean, with something like 3DS, hopefully you can just download the demo straight to the 3DS. Like,
yeah, really the middleman.
Yeah, you really shouldn't have to go through your console. But I understand that was different back in 2006. But, you know, I really like that feature. And I'm a little surprised that Nintendo hasn't built in more channels or more things on the system level that just let you interact with it. I mean, to me, there are probably quite a few ideas that you could come up with easily for, you know, ways to use your DS and your Wii at the same time that don't even involve playing a game.
There was something in Japan, right? The Mii channel connects with
the Tamagotchi collection. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there are a few things in Japan.
And there's, as I talked about, like Dogasso, Bad Brothers as a channel to play the songs through the Wii.
Right.
And, you know, there's, but it's always like really peripheral stuff.
I mean, let's be honest, the Wii Speak has more interplay with the Wii at the channel level with the Wii Speak channel. And that highlight of entertainment that Johnny, John, and I have experienced.
Yeah, the Wii Speak channel is a pretty incredible thing to try out. It's
you know what I want to do? I want to be on the Wii Speed channel with Carl on Vicodin.
You should record the next RFN.
Just make it a little more trippy than it already is.
Whoa.
Wii Speed channel.
Why are you looking at me, Greg? God.
Surprisingly entertaining. I'm not that eager to play a bunch of stuff like Crystal Chronicles or Battle Revolution where the interaction is integral to the experience. I'm not really hampering for more of that kind of stuff, but I do feel like these games that use it for, as Greg put it, peripheral features, I'm a little disappointed there aren't more of those, because I think a lot of times those little peripheral features can add a lot to the experience, like they do in DIY and a few other things that we mentioned. So to me, that's a little sad.
Yeah, they even on that level.
Well, I think that level is the appropriate level for this kind of feature.
Yeah, but
used.
Even on that level, they just haven't, you know, there's no diktat coming from the top saying you might want to think about putting this in, boys, because we're really pushing this angle. You know,
that's right. The GameCube was the GBA's albatross in that case.
The impetus is not there.
Right. I'm sure you're right about that. So the next email.
Yeah, that's me. So this is from Chris from Chicago. He says, I've been playing through Cave Story on WiiWare recently and loving every minute of it. However, as I play through the game, one thought keeps running through my mind. I wish this had been developed for the DS. It is nearly impossible for me to find the time to sit in front of a TV screen to play through long console games. I've heard Greg mention similar time constraints in the past because of my tight schedule. I selfishly wish developers would bring more major releases to the handheld market. We've already seen this happen with a few times with franchises like Dragon Quest. With the increasing technical specs of handheld systems and the massive install base of the DS, could you see more developers putting more resources behind handheld games, or will portable games always be the younger sibling to the home consoles?
Yep, so I mean, I think that message encapsulates what's happening to the games industry in Japan. I mean, you know, more and more people prefer to play games on their portable systems because that's what they've got time to play.
Well, Monster Hunter did that, right? Monster Hunter started on the, PST, PSP, and then back to
Wii. But, you know, because you know, that, especially if you're reaching out the kind of expanded audience demographics, definitely don't have time to or aren't in the habit of sitting there and playing for hours, and maybe they never did it as a kid or whatever. Portable gaming is what they could do.
Yeah.
And so I think certainly the impetus out of Japan, with Japan-centric, you know, developers and publishers and franchises, and then with the next generation of handhelds, you know, whatever Sony's going to do next, and obviously with 3DS, you will see it happen. You know, Dragon Quest IX, you know, may well be a kind of portent of things to come.
Dragon Quest IX is amazingly popular at the moment. I mean, I find it strange that Dragon Quest X is coming on the Wii, because by that time the Wii will have been out for quite a while.
Yeah,
and I just can't even see it getting the quarter of sales of Dragon Quest IX on the DS. I just don't see it. I mean, you just compare Monster Hunter.
I mean, with Dragon Quest, it's a unique situation where some people will definitely buy a Wii just to play Dragon Quest. But
that's true,
I mean, you're still right. It won't sell as well as not. You know,
I mean,
I'm quite sure of that. Despite how well despite the fact the Wii has done shockingly well for a console in Japan when the home console market is moribund.
Yeah. Well, by the way, you can look forward to Dragon Quest 9 2 for the DS. For them to recapture a little bit of the magic when 10 doesn't do so well. But by the way, I do want to add that I think it's the conventional wisdom that Monster Hunter Tri is probably going to get ported to the PSP at some point.
Hmm.
That's where the fan base is on PSP.
Yeah, Tri sold pretty well in Japan. It sold over a million. You know, I've heard people say it didn't necessarily meet their expectations, which I guess were pretty lofty. Mm-hmm. But you're talking like over 2 million for the PSP games.
Yeah.
Which, considering the PSP isn't necessarily the most popular outside of Monster Hunter, is pretty extraordinary sort of figures. And again, it goes to, you know, the way the Japanese play games. And I mean, I think that will apply to the Western markets from the point of view that, despite the success of the Wii, it's a lot easier to reach out to older people, all these different demographics with portable games. And that's what everyone in the industry, after what Nintendo's done, wants to do. They want to reach farther and farther out.
Well, let's name names. What series are going to bring their mainline sequels to primarily portable systems going forward. I mean, we've already seen this with, you know, Metal Gear Solid coming up, the Peace Walker. Yeah. I mean, that seems like it could be like a side mission or whatever, but Kojima is saying this is the new one. This is the sequel.
Well, I mean, he's saying this is the new one because this is the next one out. I mean,
No. I think the context of that was this is the next real Metal Gear Solid game.
Yeah, oh, definitely. You know, and it's not called something sort of subordinate, like right. Portable Ops. You know what I mean? I mean, that's kind of telling you it's some sort of, like, stepchild.
Wasn't the first game on the PSP like a card battling game or something?
Yes, Acid.
But, you know, I mean, you're absolutely right, Joya. That's because MGS4, I think it did quite well in Japan on PS3, considering the PS3 isn't that popular.
But compared to the cost of making it,
yeah,
exactly. I don't think it did well enough.
And then you say to yourself, Monster Hunter can sell extremely well. Something that's got that franchise cachet can sell extremely well on PSP in Japan. Mm-hmm. And that's where you see this Japan-centric thing come in. Because, you know, I don't think making a mainline Metal Gear game on PSP is going to do anything for its sales in the Western territories where PSP is so much less popular, so much less of a going concern.
Yeah, I mean, it makes more sense on DS, which is popular in both regions.
And everywhere.
In Europe, too, of course, so...
Well, and perhaps, you know, if the 3DS, you know, obviously these are the kinds of things we don't know yet, but if the 3DS is, you know, technically more competitive compared to whatever Sony does next with their handheld, because they may not focus on making it way more powerful, then maybe, you know, that would actually help it in securing some of these franchises in Japan. But, I mean, that's where we'll see it coming from. So, I mean, you're really talking about Japanese developers, you know, who would you select? And right. The thing is, I guess Capcom's not a great candidate because they have a more international kind of focus.
Right.
We've talked a lot about not just being a Japanese company. They want to be a worldwide company with worldwide appeal.
And Square Enix says that too. I don't think
they don't mean it
as much as Capcom.
But they're full of shit.
Yeah.
I just hope that Smash Brothers comes out on the 3DS.
I think it's almost inevitable that it will. Yeah. I mean, it made no sense that there wasn't a DS one except for the fact that they probably couldn't pull the resources again.
You imagine when you flinch back from the screen as Bowser hits the front, you know, when you knock him out. It's going to happen.
Well, so, we haven't named names yet in terms of, like, speculation, but I do feel like Nintendo is a bit exempt from this phenomenon just because... Nintendo, I mean, certainly they have franchises that have sort of ended up on portables because they were sort of left behind on consoles, like Kirby. And there's various reasons for that happening, maybe. But for the most part, Nintendo tends to carry its franchises forward on both console and handheld, and without porting one to the other. You know, they end up making them quite distinct, whereas, like, Sony has their God of War for PSP, which is almost exactly the same as the console games, which is, you know, both to its credit and to its demerit. But a lot of other companies, especially third parties, will basically port their console game down to the handheld. So you've even got weird cases like Silent Hill Shattered Memories is available on Wii and PSP.
PSP, right.
Even though it's one of the best games on the Wii, I can't imagine playing that game on the PSP, but they did it. And a lot of third parties are probably inclined to try to do that, especially as the portables become more and more powerful. But I think Nintendo specifically, as a developer, you don't really have to worry about, I don't think you have to worry about the next Zelda game going to DS because it's going to go to both, right? They're going to keep making them for both. So,
well, it's because they're the platform holder in every respect. They're always trying to sell each of their, you know, bits of hardware, and you know, not least for the fact that they don't tend to make a loss on hardware, so they're quite happy to sell as many units as possible. You know, give people a reason to buy that hardware. Whereas, you know, when you're talking about all these Japanese third parties, you know, they just that all they care about is putting the title out on the thing that's going to sell the most. Leaving aside the creative ambition part, which is why I'm sure it would pain Square Enix to put Final Fantasy 15 on 3DS.
Right, right.
You know, because they really seem loath to sacrifice on their ambition for Final Fantasy to always be...
I think that would actually be a good thing for them to do, to put Final Fantasy 15 on 3DS.
I think there's plenty of good arguments for it.
But they're not going to do it because of their vanity about that series. I think they believe adamantly that that system is about a certain kind of production value that they're not going to be able to get. I mean, you could go back to the N64 PS1 debacle with Final Fantasy VII, you know, where they, you know, they moved it from one system to the other because of technical issues. I mean, they're very vain about that series. They want to be the best looking thing there is.
I mean, I don't have any issue with that because its audience expects that. I mean, that is what is expected of them now.
That's why they're vain about it. I mean, I'm not.
Well, and that's also why they can't port it down to a handheld because they physically can, but from a marketing standpoint, it would be moronic because it's part of the brand is that this is going to be the best looking.
Yeah, but I mean, the question is whether you keep serving the same old fan base or whether you try and expand out. Nintendo has grappled with, and I think they're rather happier with the approach that they've taken more recently than they did to sort of preach into an increasingly small choir.
I don't think Square has that same concern. And to be honest, the games they deliver from one Final Fantasy to the next aren't nearly as similar as some of the games that you get from Nintendo with respect to things like the Zelda games.
Or Dragon Quest on the other side.
Yeah, or Dragon Quest, which is...
And as a company, they have both, and they, as a whole entity, they're kind of doing both things.
Yeah.
And recently, Square themselves have started, that they've got special teams that make, you know, one-offs, that they do these crazy stuff, and they subcontract with the developers to make things for them.
I mean, an interesting thing to look at, you know, is look at the emergence of level 5 in Japan.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and they are becoming increasingly powerful.
Powerful. They're going to shut down the government.
It's almost exclusively on the power of what they've been doing on DS.
Well, Greg, I mean, they developed Dragon Quest VIII.
Oh, they did, but I'm on about as a publisher.
You know, White Knight Chronicle, which they're not...
No, but as a publisher in Japan, because they publish Leighton themselves in Japan, whereas Nintendo publishes it everywhere else, and now they're getting bigger and bigger as their own entity. That's what I mean by, you know, powerful. They're not just their recognition as a developer of games.
Okay.
And now, you know, you see things like Ni no Kuni, which is going to have this huge DS card, and, you know, it's going to be, looks incredible for a DS game. They're really pushing the boundaries. You know, they're getting more popular, more powerful, and when you get to the next set of handheld systems that are going to be considerably more, you know, the graphics going to be better and all that, their influence is only going to grow, I think, in that way.
Yeah. I feel like Level 5, and this is maybe a little off tangent, but I feel like Level 5 is a company that in the West, we don't know how big they are, because a lot of their best games haven't come over here yet. They're in the process. So Dragon Quest IX, all the Leighton sequels.
You want to know how to describe how big they are? Level 5 has the naming rights to a soccer stadium in a city in Japan. We're not talking about a small company here.
They're making the Studio Ghibli game. I mean, a game that Nintendo, a deal that Nintendo themselves couldn't pull together. You know, they're humongous. And maybe they'll never be as big in America because they do make Japan-centric games.
Right, they are.
I mean, I do think that a lot of what they do has quite a lot of universal appeal. And as their games trickle over to the West, their name is going to grow bigger and bigger and bigger. And the thing is, they've got their hands in every pot. I mean, they do Dark Cloud with Sony. They do the Dragon Quest stuff with Square Enix. They do the Leighton stuff with Nintendo. They're like the mob. I mean, they've just got their hands in everything.
Yeah, so I mean, it isn't that easy to pick, you know, what franchises you'd go with, especially because Metal Gear is a bit of a cheat because they just did it.
Right.
Yeah.
But that is only a portent of what's going to happen with the stuff coming out of Japan. Now, whether you'll ever get the same kind of shift in America, in Europe, you know, where it's a different culture, it'll never be the same as it is in Japan, because there's various cultural reasons why portable gaming is, you know, so much more of a dominant kind of force compared to consoles there. But I mean, the fact is, you have got a situation where the DS has reached out like never before. It has sold more units than any portable that preceded it. So I mean, I think you were going in that direction, but I just don't think it's, you know, at the same time, consoles, despite the economic downturn and all that, I mean, you are seeing how strong consoles are when you look at the NPDs in America and stuff like that, you know, so it's so, so different. I mean, look at the 360.
Oh, yeah, the 360 is a whole other issue of difference. I mean, it's literally night and day.
A lot of the difference there is, of course, your home consoles and this leaving that we have, home consoles in the West, you know, I mean, you were building, you know, sort of communities around online interaction, and that's just not something that the Japanese have embraced.
Yeah. You know, I'm sure having our two Britons on this episode, you guys will appreciate this, but when I hear people from Europe talk about old computers like the ZX Spectrum, stuff like that, you know, my eyes glaze over. I've never even touched one. I don't even know what it looks like. I couldn't tell you a single game on there except Saberwolf or something.
Jet Set Willy.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, I mean, no. Willy.
It's a whole that cultural sounds... thing. I mean, it...
Dynamite Dan.
Are all these games have, like, noun, name?
Maniac Miner. There you go.
It's true. Yeah. They really do.
I mean, it's unusual in the history of video gaming. There aren't that many examples of when one region has been so cut away from a platform. And I think it happened with those computers in Europe. It happened to a much less extent with Japan and some of the early stuff like the MSX and, you know,
yeah,
some of those.
Yeah, well, I mean, the MSX never really
it happened
had that
with Japan
same.
And the first Xbox.
What is this?
If you buy an Xbox, if you buy an original Xbox, that's the launch batch, right? Even if you buy one now, that's
the
launch batch.
They didn't make another one.
The point I'm trying to make is that the way I feel about the Spectrum, you know, when I hear people talk about it now, is how people from Japan are going to feel when in 10 years when we talk about the good old days of Xbox and Xbox 360. They have no concept of what people played on those systems or why they were popular or what they were all about. It's just weird because I feel like it's this cycle repeating, but now in a totally different way and with different regions. And, you know, it's just weird that I feel like I'm now a part of this weird cultural gap that in gaming, I mean, let's face it, in gaming generally, we're used to everybody around the world playing the same systems and often playing the same games. It's become a very global phenomenon. You know, we generally play the same stuff.
And you might think, you know, especially with online and all that, you know, we're all far more aware of what everyone else is playing. You know, you might think there would be a convergence in that way.
But there's not.
And I think that's what goes to the fact that Japan culturally, beyond the gaming culture, but just in general,
right?
You know, terms of how they live is different, and that is underpinning it at the most fundamental level.
Well, talking of someone who lives in Japan, I am glad that no one knows what Halo or Modern Warfare is. I'm just happy that no one knows what the hell
good,
those games
but they're
are
good
here.
Games. You know, they're good games.
Oh, yeah, sure. But I'm just sick of people talking about it, so it's nice to not have that.
Do you want to hear about the Infinity Ward departures? I mean, you know, yes. I haven't heard enough about that. I think we haven't talked about Zampella and West or Respawn and Bungie signing a deal with Activision. I think this needs to be talked about more.
I'm with you, Greg. When you, Greg and I listen to way too many gaming podcasts, and
listen to any.
Well, when you have the steady diet of gaming podcasts, and there are certain news items that come up that everybody just swarms over, and you get sick of it. And the other thing is, and I feel bad because I've talked about this game a lot, even on our show. But when Mass Effect 2 came out, I think it's because it came out in January, it was the only thing to talk about. There were like 2 weeks when every fucking podcast I listened to had a special entire episode devoted to Mass Effect 2. Oh. And after about the fifth one, I was like, oh my god. And I hadn't played it yet. I was like,
I'm never going to play
Shut
it, probably.
The fuck up about this game.
I just fast forward over those bits.
It was the whole episode.
You can't, but yeah, you just that's just skipping to the next podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh man. Anyway, we better move on. So the final email of this week is from Oswald in New York, and he writes, I've been listening to the podcast since late September, and I grew to love you guys. I feel like you guys are my friends. I know this sounds strange, especially coming from a 22-year-old college student, but I think it would be cool if you guys can talk about yourselves for a bit. For example, where are you from? Do you have any kids? Where do you work? What are the other podcasts you listen to? What are your favorite bands, TV series, and films? Do you play any musical instruments? What do you want to achieve in life? Anyway, keep up the good work. So we're not going to have time to answer all those questions. But
no.
So because I'm not a regular, should I answer for Lindy or what?
Yeah, James.
I think make up your own story for John.
Exactly. Yeah, he was frozen in a block of ice in Canada, and a friendly Eskimo, after a few years, decided it would be the charitable thing to do to ship him down to Atlanta, where he melted and thawed and all his hair fell out, and he discovered Nintendo. And then he gave up Nintendo and started playing other systems.
But yet managed to take over Nintendo.
And that's when he became director.
Yeah.
Actually, can we talk about Zampella and West again? Because that is more interesting than my life.
I'm game. Let's go.
Yeah, well, I do appreciate, I mean, you know, because I do listen to a lot of other podcasts, I appreciate the sentiment, because I'm often very curious about the people I listen to on other shows, and I'm lucky, being in a position of being involved in the game media, is that I actually get to meet some of these people sometimes, and I'm a total fanboy around somebody like Garnet or Shane or, you know, Jeremy Parrish, Chris Kohler. I've known Chris for a long time. I still get fanboyish around him. And even being around Billy sometimes. I mean, you know, last E3, it was so weird being around Billy, watching Billy be on TV. I mean, watching Billy be in makeup on before a camera doing X-Play was crazy. And I felt starstruck around a guy I've known for 10 years. So I get it.
It's all about the makeup, man.
I get the personal interest. So I figured we would indulge a little bit here to the extent that each of us is willing to talk about ourselves. So, who wants to go first?
I'll go. I mean, hell, I might as well. So, hi, I'm James.
And by the way, this probably most useful for people who haven't been listening as long.
Right.
Hi,
yeah.
I'm James, and I'm addicted to RPGs.
Shut up! I'm 24, obviously, because we've gone over this a couple times. Mm-hmm. And from Virginia. Can't talk about exactly where I work for contractual reasons.
That's cool.
But
yeah, you don't have to be that detailed.
I work in software development. Obviously, I've spoken this a couple times, but my goal is to get into research for an artificial intelligence, but that's really expensive. And I don't have that kind of money.
James, do you have any kids?
I do. I have about 6 kids.
Oh my God.
No, I don't have any.
Did you father the octoplets? Was that you, James?
I should say, actually, none of us have kids. That's why we're able to do a Nintendo podcast every week.
Yeah. Right. I just put a water bowl out and said, call me on Monday when I'm done with this 16-hour edit.
Greg is the worst father ever.
John has the most familial obligations of a lot of us.
John is actually married. That's why he's not here tonight, actually.
But he always does mention the... Every time he comes out after a long podcast, he just gets stared at because honestly.
Well, this is a strange hobby for a married man. I mean,
it is.
Gaming, it's hard to even keep up a gaming habit when you're married, but doing a gaming podcast about your gaming habit is really, his wife is a patient angel.
Mostly you just get made fun of.
Yeah. You have to be a good sport to do this show.
To discuss music, I've mentioned this in the past. I was a former semi-professional violist.
Mm. Yeah.
But I listen to music-wise now, not a whole lot. Mostly old stuff.
And James, you said you don't listen to any other podcasts?
Not at the moment, no.
Okay. Greg?
I am one of the 5 most uninteresting people alive. I love the Buffalo Bills.
First off, that pushes you into at least 10.
What else is there about me? I do this every week. I edit the show. I mean, really, how interesting is a person that edits this show
16 hours
or more every weekend? On his weekend. That's my weekend.
You're listening to Greg's life right now.
Do you think people are breaking down the door for cocktails or a concert with that guy?
Yeah. What about you, James Charlton?
Well, I'm not a regular, so I'll keep this brief because people are not interested in me.
Yeah, but you live in Japan. I mean, you probably have the most interesting life.
I've lived in Japan for 6 years now. This is my 6th year. Mm-hmm. And actually, this could be surprising to you guys, but I am actually married.
Yeah, I've heard that.
I am married. I've been married for 3 years. And my wife is also very understanding and does glare at me when I come out of rooms for 3 hours after doing a podcast. But she's very understanding.
Yeah. And what do you do professionally, James?
I'm an English teacher, amongst other things.
Rob Banks.
What else? I don't play any musical instruments, just the Danish nasal flute. That's it.
The nose flute. Yeah.
On to you, Johnny.
Oh, okay. So
the Renaissance man.
Well,
could you have said that any more apathetically?
No, I have to be selective here because I am sort of interested in everything, and I've been lucky. I've had quite an interesting life for most part, I think. So yeah, I'm from Alabama, as most of you probably know, and lived there for 24 years. Actually, started to lose my accent while going to college in Alabama. And, I didn't realize it really, so I just got used to it. But anyway, I live in Colorado now, although currently I'm spending a few weeks in Houston, and that's because I am doing research at NASA. So, like I said, I'm very fortunate. I have quite an interesting life. So I'm a PhD student. I've been in college for 10 years. It will be 10 and a half by the time I graduate in December. And I do want to be an astronaut, although that's reductionist because no one is just an astronaut. I mean, you don't even get selected until you're like 35 or 40. So you got to have a real career, and then that's like a subset of your career, or that's a career change midstream. And so I'm an aerospace engineer, mostly interested in research. So, doing kind of researching technologies or something like that. Involved with human spaceflight. That's the passion of my life other than fucking video games. And,
the difference in profundity.
Yeah, I know. I probably spend more time on video games, but I have a lot of musical interests as well. I sing, I play harmonica, not as much as these guys might lead you to believe. Actually, I haven't played much. I was telling them a couple weeks ago, the day I bought my Xbox 360, damn near quit harmonica at that point because I just had so many games I wanted to play and could play that, slightly more responsible hobbies like learning a musical instrument really fell by the wayside. I have to fight to keep exercising. I have so many damn games. Okay, well, we're going to close out the show now. Before we go, I wanted to say a couple things. First off, in terms of programming, we will do Retroactive next week, so we're going to talk about Metroid 2. So if you have been playing, I hope you will continue to do so. The thread is up, the forum thread is up, so go to the website and look for that. Post your thoughts. We will be reading comments from that thread on the show next week. So I hope you'll go there and contribute something and join in the discussion, have some back and forth there. I think there's already some good discussion going on. And I think we'll probably do that all in one week. It's a fairly short game, and we've had a good bit of time to play it and acquire it. So we'll all try to finish it or get pretty far into it before then. I did notice, this was kind of maybe out of the blue, but I did read this week that Matt Casamassina is leaving IGN and going to Apple. And I kind of wanted to throw out a quick comment on it because, or I guess just send him well wishes. Not that I know he doesn't listen to the show, but
ass.
I want to show him some respect because, Matt was one of my...
Too late.
No. I mean, Matt was one of my idols when I started doing this stuff back in the late 90s.
Had little posters of him in his room?
No. I mean, no. I mean, in fact, Matt and I we've been rivals for a long time. When I was director of the site and he was editor-in-chief of IGN, Wii, and GameCube, I mean, we were rivals. And we've always been, we've always been pretty friendly rivals. So I do want to wish him well. I feel like there aren't that many institutions in the gaming media. And, I feel like our website is one of them. We've been around for 11 years. And I just feel like in gaming media, people shift around a lot. A lot of people go to developers or go to PR, yada, yada, yada. It's unusual for a guy to be around for 15 years like Matt Casamassina was and was associated with Nintendo all of that time. So I feel like in the world of Nintendo media, he was really quite an icon. And so I just send him my well wishes as he goes off to do something with the App Store. God help him.
And on that note, rate and review on iTunes, everyone. Spread the gospel of the show.
Exactly. You got to send your votes through Matt Casamassina now.
Actually, email him directly.
Yeah. Anyway, that's all for this week. Send your letters to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Thank you to everybody who wrote in. And by the way, James Charlton, do you have a plug before we go?
I do. If people are not already completely sick of me on this podcast and they want more, then please download Radio Trivia and I will be on that discussing games with TYP.
Excellent. I can't wait to hear
it. Got a British streak going. We got it going. I don't know how the hell I'm going to keep it up next time because we're not going to be editing. But
no, we'll get Carly's back on, so we'll get her to do the next one.
We'll rotate. We'll annex that particular podcast in typical colonial style.
Okay, thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And James has the first question this week.
Hamed from Oman writes, in the first Zelda game on the DS, Link had a role other than just being...
But it was last Zelda game on the DS.
Well, fine, on the last one,
it's important distinction!
No, it matters. It matters.
it's still technically true, because he was a freaking sailor in the first one, so... He was! I didn't make it up. It's not
right, just try and read it so it doesn't sound weird and edited, because this is getting cut, obviously.
Okay, fine. In the...
fuck's sake.
This is what happens whenever Greg throws up a red flag because I screw up an important word. Alright. Serious face time.
You know, it really bothered me in Twilight Princess because you did have this one character who's very clearly set up as a potential romantic interest for Link. I forget her name, but she's, you know, one of the kids.
The ones in the village.
Right, yeah. She's this teenage girl and she's, you know, meant to be attractive within the bizarre art
the
style.
The art style they adopted for that game. I was, as long as you're not going for Bug Girl, I'm fine.
Oh, I was about to mention Bug Girl.
This is... Jeez Louise.
Bug Girl was hot.
Greg's like, Bug Girl, gone.
Girl, cut. If I could seal it in the sacred realm, the audio, I'd do it.
Actually, you know, while they're using musical instruments as keys, I think Link's next musical instrument should be that crazy fucking key from the He-Man movie.
Oh, yeah, the Dwildor.
The musical key, yeah.
I've just shamed myself, Dwildor.
Dwildor? Are you serious?
Yeah, that's his name. He reminds me of Harry Knowles. That's what I remember.
Oh, my God.
That's
so
bad.
Can we get to the next question?
And you got Strickland out of Back to the Future. Oh, Jesus.
Greg, I don't know who you've insulted more with that, yourself or Harry Knowles.
Yeah, oh, it's everyone.
So for those of you listening at home, you'll never hear that because Greg will remove it.
You are fucking right. I'll either remove it entirely or bleep it out or do something else.
The He-Man
movie is a piece of shit.
It's
made by Golden Globus, who make pieces of shit or made pieces of shit throughout the whole 80s.
But you have to admit, Frank Langella's makeup is terrifying.
Apart from the fact he has eyes and he's skeletal.
But still.
He has eyes. Shit.
Yeah.
I really wish we had, like, a version of this out there that people could just listen to and be like, what are they talking about? Oh, my God.
Yeah, I'm going to have to earn my money this week.
We should have RFN uncut edition.
Just like,
what for TV?
Just like a chart
so
that
many
different
ways.
Timelines what we were talking about. 1 hour, 37 minutes. Frank Langella. Skeletor. What?
Who would win in a fight at a Skeletor mix?
Oh, God. I'm not a hippie, but I like their music. You guys have anything more to add before we wrap this up?
Assuredly not.
No.
Assuredly not. Okay.
We're good.
Yes, some people are private, and I guess I'm
other
not,
people so. Are just really fucking uninteresting.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but Lindy's not here. Boom.
No, because if we were going to do the discussing about Lindy, we could just make powder jokes for the entire time he's trying
no,
to
no, talk. No, powder.
John's an
interesting
guy.
You wouldn't get but JC might get the Duncan Goodhue reference.
Duncan Goodhue. It does look like him.